Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United, welcome everybody. This is Jamie.
And this is Jerry. Welcome to our show tonight.
We're excited. We get
I'm
to talk
very
Altman
excited.
Tonight.
I don't know why, but I'm just like really excited. I'm always excited when we get on the air. So maybe it's just because I have no place else to really let it all out, you know?
You're boxing now, though, aren't you?
I take a boxing class a couple times a week. It's just something new. It's very exciting, and it's very hard, I may add, too. Like the hardest workout, the hardest hour of my life. Let's put it like that.
Beating the hell out of somebody doesn't get it all out for you.
Well, no. It's a combination of things. It's a very aerobic cardio workout. It's hard work. I don't mean to paraphrase our former president, but it's hard work.
Yeah, I bet. I'd never. It's hard enough for me to attempt to get off the couch and change the channel.
Oh, you're not a slouch. You always make me feel happy. You're not a slouch at all. Stop that. Okay?
Right.
So you're I saw those photos you posted. Those are pretty cool.
Intellectually, I'm in very top condition, I hope.
Yeah, you are.
Physicality is another issue. But enough about that.
Yeah, really. We want people to listen to the show. They don't want to hear about our lives.
Right. Exercise Geeks United.
Yeah.
This is first hour of the show. We'll be discussing the legacy of Robert Altman, his tremendous body of work, what made him unique and special in the pantheon of American filmmakers. In support of a new book, we're doing this show, a great book called Robert Altman, The Oral Biography, which we're going to hear about that a little bit later. First, Jerry, Altman, his place with you as a movie fan.
With my place as a movie fan, you don't really have to go back much further than McCabe and Mrs. Miller. We talked about that movie, but that movie means a lot to me because we watched it a lot in high school.
Yeah.
We just watched it constantly in high school. Not only that, you know what the first movie I saw of Altman's was? You're going to laugh, but it was Popeye in 1980.
I think that's true of a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of us in this generation. That was the first film we saw by him, and then you know, we went back and watched MASH and Nashville. And I love McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but you know, I think my all-time favorite film is Shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
I love Shortcuts. I think Shortcuts is perfect. Now, you got to remember, in the early 90s, before The Player, Altman was, you know, written off by a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't really considered relevant anymore. And The Player comes along, based on the Michael Tolkien's brilliant black comedy of a novel, and that put him back in the game for the remainder of his life. I know it's really weird to say that, but it's true. But Shortcuts comes along, and I had read a lot of Raymond Carver stories the year before in college, and then Shortcuts comes along. And Shortcuts is brilliant on every level. It's the best up in, you know, it's the film Crash wants to be so badly. I have no problem saying that because I think Shortcuts is Carver, but it's also a brilliant film about what it means to live in Los Angeles. And the great irony of that is the best film about living in Los Angeles was made by his protege, Alan Rudolph, many decades before, called Welcome to L.A. And Altman is just – there are only two directors I could really think to compare that even are in the same league as him right now that are making films today that I see the influence in. But Altman was just in a class by himself.
Well, you know he's a a true artist when you see their stamp, and he had a very unique way of working in
mm-hmm.
that he wasn't concerned with story, he wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily concerned with script. He said, "You got a better idea, bring it on." He was very, very trusting of his actors
yeah.
and let them loose. He wanted a sense of real life unfolding in his films, a sense of anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the overlapping dialogue that he kind of pioneered more than anyone else certainly speaks to that. He wanted the accidents to happen on camera, the spontaneity.
Yeah.
But he was also ahead of his time. He was a visionary, and there are things that he brought forth in Nashville, say, you know, the
mm-hmm.
the portrait of society in Nashville,
yeah.
A portion of which certainly had to do with the ending of the film, the
right.
Celebrity assassination.
Right.
And that spoke to a lot of events that occurred later. There's an account in this book where the second John Lennon was assassinated. They called him.
Yeah.
And they said, do you feel partially responsible for this?
Mm.
And because of the ending of your movie. And he said, do you feel responsible for not heeding my warning? He said, you know, the assassinations, they're not about the celebrity. They're about the assassin wanting more attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Also, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. McCabe
yeah.
and Mrs. Miller are real. I mean, we're living it today. This is the tried and true story that we're living in society today. Capitalism, in some sense, the movie's about the capitalistic system and how it muffles the little man with the dream.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. But there's also another thing I like about his films, all of his films, actually, going back, even something like the one about Nixon, Secret Honor, he's not, his films, I know a lot of people would like to say they're cynical. I don't think they're cynical, and he's not judgmental. He doesn't, it's almost as though the camera's a fly on the wall, and it's
mm-hmm.
almost as if it's a documentary. I think that's very important to bring out, because there is, in the 90s, there's a lot of cynicism in films, and I don't mean that as a negative at all, but there's no cynicism in his films. He doesn't pass judgment on Julie Christie's character in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. She's a working person. She's someone trying
yeah.
to make a living. He passes no judgment on her, and that's very important, because if that movie was made by someone else at that time, there might have been, you know, someone would have been a very moralistic view of that character.
And also very bold in his artistic choices. The look of his films, his casting was at times very bold. I mean,
yeah.
casting Elliot Gould as the lead in The Long Goodbye, the kind of Marlowe character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's an incredible casting. The other film that we don't talk about a lot, and one that I need to watch again, is Thieves Like Us.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one. I mean, there's so many gems. There are more gems than duds. I know a lot of people. I was really disheartened to go on IMDb, as I'm always disheartened to go on IMDb, because the negative commentary outweighs the positive. But when it came to Robert Altman, I was shocked at just how many people just wrote him off.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't like message boards. I really don't. But on IMDb, it's like, even if you have a good idea, it goes to die immediately. But he was just, like you said, so ahead of his time. And he was the first director, I think, probably since he was really inspired by Grand Hotel, the multi-character stories, and he was able to always balance it. He never lost track of any characters whatsoever, whether it was
mm-hmm.
a wedding or three women, whatever. He always kept that all very well balanced. He never lost track of anything.
If you think about his casting, too, with Keith Carradine and Shelley Duvall,
mm-hmm.
he could use them. I mean, Shelley Duvall she's unusual. You know, and Altman had a way of bringing her out and making her magical in his
right.
films. Very unusual quality. And he made some odd films, some oddball films. The Brewster McClouds and Images.
Yeah.
And then the 80s, as you said, he was relegated to kind of starting his own stuff and filming a lot of film versions of stage plays, like Streamers
yeah.
and Come Back to the Five and Dime.
And Fool for Love. was towards the end of the 80s.
Sam Shepard, right,
yeah.
Right. And if you think about kind of the projects that might have been, he didn't get along with the studios, obviously. He was a man that did not bow to authority.
No, that's very true.
And so he missed out on some opportunities, one of which was Ragtime,
mm-hmm.
Which he was very upset about. And Ragtime would have been a vastly different movie, probably a lot better movie, even though there's, you know, it's a good movie in its own right.
It's a good movie, but I don't think that's Milos Forman, right?
Yeah.
And it's Howard E. Rollins was the breakout star of that film, as I remember. Yeah, no, that would have been a completely different film under him.
It begs for Altman's special take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we talk about a lot of this and more with our next guest. His name is Mitchell Zuckoff. And the book is Robert Altman, The Oral Biography, and it is a gem. If you're a movie fan, buy it, because it's one of the best biographies I've read. And it's an oral biography, which means it reads like an Altman film, and that all these voices are coming in to commentate. And believe that. And this is a terrific book. And he spent time with Mr. Altman. It was at first it was conceived as Altman's memoir, and then sadly Mr. Altman passed in the midst of Mitchell working on this, and it kind of took a new shape. And so here's our conversation with author Mitchell Zuckoff about Robert Altman. I adore this book, as I told you.
Thank you.
And the first thing that interests me is how it came to be, because you are an investigative journalist of some of great acclaim, and you've written books in the past, but none centering around the film world. So how did this project come to be?
This is an incredibly nice way for you to say, who the heck are you to write this book? And I appreciate that. And I'm good with that, actually, Jamie. You're right. It was serendipity. I was, like so many people, a huge Robert Altman fan, and it just so happened that when Bob Altman agreed to do a memoir, he had the same editor that was the editor of my last book, Ponzi Scheme. And just it was sort of people talking, who might we link Bob Altman up with to help him write a book like this? Who's a good interviewer, who's, you know, maybe got the ability to do this? And I think half on a lark, my then-editor, John Karp, said to my agent, hey, do you think Mitch would be interested? And one thing led to another, and my agent called me, and I said, yeah, I'd love to meet Bob Altman. I mean, I didn't expect him to go for it either. I figured he'd meet me and say, well, you know, show me all your film writing. And that would have been the shortest conversation in the world.
Right.
But he didn't.
Wow. So you met with him. You met with him, and you took to each other.
You know, I took to him. I can't speak for him, but I think he did take to me. We sat in his house in his apartment in New York, and mostly we talked about baseball. And I'm a big Red Sox fan, and he grew up in Kansas City, so we both hated the Yankees. So sort of, you know, based on not a lot more than that, as far as I could tell. I walked out. My agent was there, too. And I walked out, and I realized we had been there for over an hour, and we had only talked for about 5 minutes about how something like this would work. I would interview him. I would help him. I would frame things. And I said, well, clearly he's not interested in me. And next thing I knew, we were off to the races.
So his goal was to craft a memoir with your assistance about what it takes to direct, a kind of primer on directing?
Yeah. A primer on directing, a primer on his philosophy of making movies,
mm-hmm.
How you do it, how you work with people, how you treat people, in the best sense, how you treat with, you know, the actors, the performers, but also how you sort of fight back against the suits and push back against producers whose work would sort of interrupt your own vision.
Mm-hmm.
He really did not want this to be a biography. He felt as though, I think I say something in the introduction about this, that, you know, he didn't want people just looking at his work through the lens of his life. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to talk about the work. He loved talking about making movies and making, you know. And so I said, okay. But then as we were doing it, I frankly was getting nervous because it's impossible to separate this man from his work.
Mm.
It's so distinctive.
We're going to talk a lot about that, but first of all, before you met him, I want to know your consciousness of his work. When did that start for you, and which films were you particularly taken by?
Well, I was a big fan, and I remember as a teenager seeing MASH,
mm-hmm.
and I remember feeling as though, wow, are we going to get caught? You know, this is just too cool. The anarchy, the anti-establishment, you know, it was like the perfect adolescent boys, you know, wonder world of what war must be like. And so my consciousness really goes back a long time, all the way back to my teenage years. And then, I mean, I loved MASH so much. Nobody remembers this, but after the movie came out, before the TV show, there was a series of follow-up books to the original Hooker novel. And it was like MASH Goes to Las Vegas, MASH Goes to London. These are terrible books. I read them all as a kid.
Wow.
I was so hoping to sort of recapture what I felt there in the theater. You know, of course it didn't work. But so my idea of Altman goes back really to, you know, my early teens.
Yeah,
when I kind of half snuck in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was it about MASH that spoke to you? Was it the bravery of it? What was that?
You know, I think now I would say the bravery. Back then, it was the anarchy of it.
Mm.
It was the idea that, you know, these guys were so good. The first time I saw it, it was really, I saw it on the surface. I saw it as these raucous, rule-breaking surgeons who are so good and so cool, and they get all the girls, and they blow off the brass and they blow off the bureaucracy, and they're just the coolest guys you've ever, you know, seen.
Mm.
And so that was my adolescent view of it. But as I got older, I saw it again, and I understood. And the thing that really blew me away was when I understood that there was a conscious mind behind this, a director's mind behind this. And that he was commenting on Vietnam through by using this sort of ruse of Korea. And the idea that he was speaking to so many other things about war movies. I mean, there's, you know, the idea that there's one gun that goes off in MASH, and it's, you know, to end the quarter in the football game. And that's against the rules of a war movie.
Right.
And the idea that you can just make something through your own ideas and through just the way you wanted to make it and not follow the genres and not follow what's come before was very exciting to me as I was sort of figuring out just, you know, my own path. And
mm-hmm.
it's like any work of art. You know, why does a particular picture speak to you if you're walking through a museum or a particular, you know, work in marble? It touches you somewhere deep.
Yeah, those aspects that you mentioned of MASH, that you found in MASH, I mean, they're characteristic, obviously, of all of his work. They break all the rules. They deconstruct genres. For me, I remember I had seen several of Altman's films, and then I discovered McCabe. And that movie punched me in the gut. It is the most beautiful, sad movie I've ever seen. Just a melancholy film like I've never seen, and it made me go back and reassess his other work that I'd already seen, and I saw it in a whole new light somehow after the McCabe
experience. I love hearing that. I have to tell you, Jamie, I'm not just saying because you just said this. You know, people ask me if I really had to pick one. I think Masterpiece, I go to Nashville, but personal favorite is McCabe.
Yeah.
Each time I see it, it just... it just it affects me very deeply now, especially as an adult. I wouldn't have gotten it as a kid.
But getting back to the process of writing the book real quick, and then we'll get into, obviously, the content of the book. So you became very close to Mr. Altman and his wife, who factors very prominently in the book. And at what stage in the writing of the book did Mr. Altman pass?
Well, you know, I've always tried to quantify it. I guess we were about halfway. I mean, we were still interviewing. I was framing out some early chapters in my mind and in draft form, but I felt like I needed about the same amount of formal interviewing, because we would interview for a few hours and Bob would say, "Come on, let's just watch the game," and you know we'd hang out the rest of the night, and it was great. I loved it, but you know, it wasn't all productive time.
Right.
So I was probably about halfway done.
And at that point, you kind of have to reexamine where you want to go with the book, if there's going to be a book at all, I would imagine.
Oh, I was like a cautionary tale of what not to do in publishing. We didn't have the contract signed. I spent months and months flying back and forth. You know, I live in Boston, flying back and forth to L.A., to his house in Malibu, going down to New York and spending days and days there. And the contract was sort of in the works, and one agent was dealing with another, and I just said, I don't care. I really wanted to get onto it. Bob dies, and then I've got no contract, and I've got no book. And it's like every writer's worst nightmare. It's what you don't do when you're working on a book. You don't do that much work or spend your own money.
Yeah.
But I'm delighted I did, because once a few months passed, and, you know, the sadness and the more important things passed, Catherine and I talked, and, some agents and people like that got involved and said, wait a second, these are Bob Altman's last interviews. These are effectively his last words.
Mm.
We really should use them. And in talking about it, it just became clear to me that the way to do it is really let him have his last words by using them, not filtered through my typewriter or my computer, but by supplementing them with a couple of hundred other voices that help bring them to life in many different shades.
Yeah, and these voices are amazing. Obviously, most of the people that he worked with closely in his creative life and his family life as well. There's a lot of personal relationships drawn in this book as well, but when you were tracking down all of these people, what was a common thread among all of them on their outlook of Mr. Altman? Because what surprised me was how contradictory he was. There were so many contradictions in the man. He hated the studio system, and yet he had to have the studio system to make a lot of his best work. He was spoken about with such reverence, and yet the same people said he could turn on them on a dime.
Yeah,
he was a complicated man, I found.
Very much so. I think I'm happy to hear you say that, because I think that's one of the goals of this book, was to show that, was to show his many sides.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, the one thing that everyone had in common was that this was an indelible personality.
Mm.
Everybody who came in contact with him, whether it was, Jerry Steinhoff as a teenage girl in his high school, or somebody who met him a year before he died, they just had just indelible images of him, such strong impressions. He made incredibly powerful impressions on people. And so it made my job easy in a way, because you sort of get people talking about Bob Altman, and they've got stories to tell, and they've got strong feelings. Nobody was lukewarm.
Yeah.
even people who loved him, dearly and deeply, had some sort of horrifying stories to tell.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's the one thing they all have in common.
He was an indelible presence. Yeah, you feel that in this book. And one of the one of the voices represented in this book, I was very happy to see. You spoke with Warren Beatty, and because McCabe is so close to my heart, I'm always curious about their working relationship, and you spent a lot of time on this book illustrating that relationship. That was a hard interview to get, wasn't it?
The hardest, yeah. Bar none. I mean, the other ones were difficult, just more in terms of scheduling, but Warren Beatty, to his credit, he clearly had a complicated, very difficult relationship with Bob Altman, and they had sort of circled around each other for the 35 years that followed. And he clearly, I would call him, I called him several times a week for months, and would always get once in a while he would pick up, I would usually get an assistant, and they were unfailingly polite and unfailingly kind. But they said, let me see if Mr. Beatty is available. And they'd come back and say, call back in a few days. And clearly he was working through this. He was trying to figure out whether he was going to talk to me. And finally, after months and months of this, I get a call. I called one day, and they said, he's not available, but we'll see. Maybe we'll call you back. And I didn't think anything of it because I'd been through so much. And then he actually called back. I have Mr. Beatty on the line for you.
Wow.
And okay. And so he quizzed me. At first, he still had his doubts. He wanted to make sure I had done my homework and sort of, making sure I knew certain things about who was involved, who Julie Christie I'd already talked to, and, just little sort of details on the set of, Maisie Hoy and all these, the other hookers. And I was like, I guess I got the answers right. Because then we just went to work. And he answered everything. He was great. We spent close to 2 hours, over an hour and a half at least, talking that day. And he didn't dodge a single question. He answered everything. And obviously it's a little bit of a Rashomon effect where he has his version of events.
Right.
Catherine Altman has hers. And Michael Murphy has his. And it's up to the reader to decide, what they find most credible.
Yeah. For me, it was fascinating to read, but in the end, what difference does any of it make? Because they've made a perfect work of art that'll live as long as there are movies. Yeah.
That was so freeing to me, because nothing I can do can screw up that movie.
Yeah. Right,
I can't touch it. I can't lay a glove on it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you know this, but I'm sure you do with all your research that you've done for this book, but in speaking with David Foster, who you also spoke to, did he tell you about after the Oscars, I think, after Altman received his honorary Oscar, they were having lunch together, and I guess Warren Beatty walked in?
Yes.
And they embraced? Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing, amazing.
He did tell me that story. I love that story, and David was just wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful guy. The one other person that I have to ask you about that you spoke to
sure.
is Paul Newman.
Oh, I was so grateful that he was great. He was just, he was not a hard get. He was an interesting guy. He didn't use email, and so when I called his office, they said, "Well, fax a letter to Mr. Newman." So I said, okay. And he's, I think, the last guy on the planet who had a fax machine. And they called right back, and we set up a time.
Wow.
And he was great. He was terrific.
Yeah. Now, what interests me about Altman, one of the facets that interests me about him, he in the 70s, there was this core group of filmmakers – And that had
sure.
a real camaraderie with one another, the Coppola, Spielberg, Scorsese, Schrader.
Yeah.
But Altman, maybe it was because he was a little bit older, but he was kind of separated from that. So where did he fit into the mold of that generation of filmmaker? And what did his contemporaries think of him, and what did he think of them?
He didn't love talking about his contemporaries. Mm-hmm. Whenever he would bring up a film, and there were certainly people he admired, Martin Scorsese, he admired these people as filmmakers. But whenever I would bring up those people, and even if I read other people's interviews with him, he was a very competitive guy. And he didn't want to, and he didn't want to be part of the club. And so he didn't love talking. He said it was so hard to watch their movies because either he would feel so angry that he didn't make it and so jealous that, he would just, get angry and it wouldn't be worth it, or he would hate it so much he'd be tempted to say something publicly about how much he hated it, and then he becomes persona non grata even more in Hollywood.
Right, right, right. But he had such a unique voice, and one of the aspects of his work that I find so unique was that he seemed to have, and I think he admitted to this, an aversion to story.
Yes.
And one of the best quotes that I saw was about the last movie he was prepping, The Hands on a Hard Body, I think was the
yes.
name of the film. And one of the quotes in your book, I forget who it's attributed to, but Altman told him, I don't know what it's about. I haven't made
it Alan
yet.
Ladd. Right.
Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. Yeah,
but it's so Altman.
Yeah.
I'll tell you when I'm done. He even said when he was making Prairie Home Companion, he swears he didn't know it was about death.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, only afterward, after it all came together, he said, yeah, now, of course, I know it's about, it's an elegy. It's a story about death.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and that, you captured it perfectly. He didn't want to have it all storyboarded out there and then just, sort of see his vision. He was not a Kubrick who had everything within an tenth of a degree of the camera angle before he shot it, all figured out in his head. He didn't want that. That was the opposite of what he wanted.
Yeah.
And to capture behavior rather than plot, you had to let it just happen.
I think that's a good comparison to make with Kubrick, because
thank you.
Because you really see that control. That obsessive control in Kubrick's films, and with Altman's films, they're living things. I mean, you can feel them evolving.
Do you know the scene? You'll know this scene in McCabe. It's near the end. It's when the church is on fire, and the a mule comes running through the screen.
Right.
And it's just sort of next time you see it, you'll see it, and it's probably on screen for about 3 or 4 seconds. That was completely accidental. The fire scared the horses and the mules, and one of them got free. He saw it running by, and he just turned the camera onto it and said, "Get that." And so Vilmos, it's my understanding, this is how I understand the story, and Vilmos will confirm or deny it, but he said, get that. It's great, because it wasn't scripted. It wasn't planned.
He wanted life. He wanted to be surprised, didn't he?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Even so, were there themes that obsessed him, that he was obsessed by exploring?
I'm not sure I would say themes. He was obsessed with human reaction, with the way a person would react in crisis and in stress, and watching people and being surprised by people you expected to react one way, very badly, perhaps, and instead reacting really honorably. And you think of Shortcuts and you think of the baker, here you think he's a horrible person, he's been harassing her, and then he makes her bread when he realizes what's really happening. And that kind of surprising turn of behavior, well, certainly it was Carver's work that it's the basis of, but that kind of moment when something true in someone's behavior is revealed is what, if anything, was something that obsessed him.
How did he, when he looked at society or the people and their relationship to one another, excuse me, in your take on this, was he a pessimist, an optimist, or a realist?
A realist leaning towards pessimist. he definitely had a cynical streak. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a guy who, you know, you can look at, you know, almost 40 movies and not see a lot of happy endings here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think he had seen enough and experienced enough to know that, here's how he explained it when people asked him that. Look at the end of The Player. Now, it looks like an unhappy ending for the Bonnie Shero character. You know, she's been thrown over by Tim Robbins' character. She breaks her heel and she's crying there. But what Bob would say is, well, yeah, it seems, the stories don't end. That might have been the greatest thing in the world for her to have happen.
Yeah.
That she was finally out from under this guy who was completely amoral. And it might have set her on this horrible, horrible episode in her life. It might have set her on an amazing path. So, now, he had a little bit of optimism in him, I guess.
You really had to dig for it, though. Yeah.
You had to dig. You had to look beyond the last frame, I think.
Right, right. Did he have a movie of his own that he was particularly fond of, or did he just group them all as... I know he made a statement when he accepted his Oscar that I just see them as one long film.
Yeah. He would always refuse to answer that, but if you pushed him hard enough, he would always pick a film like Booster McCloud.
Mm-hmm.
And he would explain that, you know, they're all your children, and in some ways you love the ones that aren't necessarily the tallest and most handsome. And so, you know, and partially it was... You know, to be a little bit of a little cheeky to pick a film
right.
like that that was on nobody's list, frankly, or almost nobody's list. But you know, I think he loved all his films, and he truly, you know, it became a little bit of a cliche with him that he said they're like your children, but I think on some level he meant it.
Well, he did some very odd. Just downright strange, quirky films.
Yeah, he absolutely.
Was such a risk taker. And the other favorite Altman film of mine is actually The Company. And I remember watching
that.
Yeah, I remember watching that and thinking he's done it. He's done a film that does not rely on the three-act structure. You know, there's none of that. It is a portrait of the company, and then you feel like you've spent time in their shoes, and then that's it. I mean, you know, it's... I thought it was a brilliant, brave film.
You should go back, if you haven't already, and I think I used the excerpt, but Roger Ebert's review of The Company does such a good job capturing what you've just described that Ebert got it, and Ebert, who knew Robert Altman's work as well as anybody, would say, you know, that the company captured the artistic process as Altman knew it and Altman experienced it.
Yeah,
that he superimposed his own experience of making films onto one season in a ballet company.
Do you see anyone carrying the torch, Altman's torch? I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson is probably an obvious example of.
I think Paul is the closest I can think of. I mean, you know, Wes Anderson does some interesting things too, but I think. The way we should look at the torch as much as anything is who is making really personal films? Who really isn't doing one for the studio than one for me? And I think Paul Thomas Anderson, I think Wes Anderson, I think there are a few guys out there who are saying, I'm going to sort of stay outside the system and see how long I can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe Spike Jonze?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
We can look at other filmmakers that have been influenced, and you can see glimpses of their influence in their films, but only one Robert Altman. I mean, you can't duplicate that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think they'd be foolhardy to try.
Yeah.
You know, I think they would almost have to start by going back and being 18 years old and flying a bomber in World War II, and I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. So many things shaped him that you know, I'm not replicable.
Yeah. His films are just treasures in my life, and now I'm happy to say your book is a treasure in my life too.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate you writing it. I really appreciate you giving me your time today to talk about it.
My pleasure, really. I really enjoyed this.
Okay, that's author Mitchell Zuckoff. The book is Robert Altman, The Oral Biography. It's out Tuesday. You can purchase it right now from our website here. Just click on that link. It'll take you to Amazon, and you can purchase it and get it at your doorstep by the time it comes out in stores.
That was a great, great interview. I'd like to add some stuff to that because you mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson, and that's the obvious choice, I mean, mm-hmm. and the right choice. I don't know about Wes Anderson and Spike Jonze. I don't mean that in a condescending way at all. I just don't know if I see so much Altman in them. I see other directors in them. But
I see Altman in them because of what he said. Someone that works outside of the system is unique.
Oh yeah, and, unique. But there are two directors, and there are two directors. I think the most obvious is Hal Hartley, who has yet mm-hmm. to really find a studio that likes him or a studio that he likes. This is a man who, on Fresh Air in 2000, I think it was 2000. George Washington through Snow Angels are definite Altman-esque films. I can't think of another director with the exception of Paul Thomas Anderson that really captures Altman's essence, especially in the early films like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Three Women.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. And I'm also very happy that you brought up The Company, because that's a great film, a very underappreciated film.
Yeah, I do remember watching The Company and thinking, man, this film is completely unique, and obviously it was a movie that was spearheaded by Neve Campbell, and Robert Altman didn't know anything about ballet, didn't know anything about dance, but that creative process is what drew him. Can you hear me now, Jerry? Now Jerry's gone. We're having a big problem with our phone lines. Jerry's phone went out, and now his phone is dropped completely. All right, so the book is Robert Altman, The Oral Biography, and actually Altman was working on a film. Here he is. He's back.
I got cut off.
Yeah, we're having all these phone issues today.
I know.
Very professional of us.
Yeah, I know. It's not our fault. We're not to blame here.
No, we're really not. Listen to this. You know that before Altman's death, he was going ahead on a project called Hands on a Hard Body.
That's right, and that was I remember that whole thing. You know, that it's based on and everything. So yeah,
based on a documentary. What was it? A contest where all
the
these
contest
people?
Contest where you had to hold on to the car. They wanted to bring home. You know, it was for people who wanted to bring home this car for free. You know, if they held on to touch it the longest for, I forget how long it was, how many, was it a day or 2 days or a whole weekend? But,
yeah,
it was incredible. It was like one of these things you read about, you're like, oh, my God, you know? But, yeah, he would have been perfect for that. Could you see the whole thing he could create for that?
Absolutely, and he knew how he wanted to do it. And they had already started casting. Now, listen to this cast that they had already assembled, and they weren't done yet. Meryl Streep, Chris Rock, The Rock, Steve Buscemi, Tommy Lee Jones, Jack White from The White Stripes,
wow.
Jack Black, Salma Hayek, Billy Bob Thornton, John C. Reilly, Hilary Swank. They were all attached to do this film with him.
And that would have been incredible. I mean, that would have been, he was always so good at doing that. Look at Gosford's Park. Look at Prairie Home Companion. I mean, every decade, there are these ensemble casts that just, he did it better than anyone.
Yeah, he really did, and the actors that loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're hearing that it's dead air. in the chat room. Please, somebody type in if you can hear us both talking.
Yeah, if you can hear us, please type something in.
The actors that worked with him, I mean, they just rushed to work with him because I think that they enjoyed the freedom of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. You know, you just said it right there. Altman was in that very much way was like David Lean. He always said to people in the money department, you know, you can spare, you know, to lose some money or whatever. But the whole thing with Altman was he really didn't care. He wanted to make movies. He really did not care about the revenue or anything. And that's what made him so great. He was a rebel. He was a rebel to the very end.
And, you know, you bring up Popeye, and I was talking to another friend, and he said that Popeye was a favorite of his as a child. It takes me a second to equate Popeye with Robert Altman because it seems so out of sync with the rest of his resume, and yet in the manner in which it was done, I mean, it is an Altman film.
I mean, it's got a large cast. That was I guess at the time that was made, that was a big vehicle really for Robin Williams.
Yeah.
That's what I was
saying. that was the first real entry into theatrical films he had out of Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, no, that was that, and then I think after that, World According to Garp and everything comes after. But Popeye was really the big thing.
Yeah. And Robin Williams is interviewed in connection with this book, and he talks about how arduous the shoot was. I think it was probably the most difficult shoot of Altman's career. We can't talk about Robert Altman either without talking about how he deconstructs genre, because he was the ultimate at that. You thought you'd seen a Western. This might explain why possibly his films, for a large part, weren't as financially successful as they deserve to be, because you think you're going to see a Western. You have an idea of what that'll be, and you get McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
But is that a bad thing, though?
No, it's not a bad thing. I'm just saying that's probably why.
Because look at the Westerns that, all right, you look at McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and let's look 2 years ago, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. That's directly influenced by McCabe and Mrs. Miller, among other things, but as far as the architecture and the imagery goes, that's straight from McCabe. There's no arguing that than the way it's paced and everything, and it's beautifully paced. I could watch that movie. Why I don't own that on Blu-ray is a sin. But
it's not on Blu-ray.
It is
McCabe?
On no, Assassination.
Oh.
Hey, let me tell you about McCabe. I still proudly have my VHS copy of that film. But no.
That's something that needs a special edition.
It needs to be remastered. It needs a Criterion edition.
You're right.
It's an important film, and not only the Assassination of Jesse James, but the Australian film, the John Hillcoat film, The Proposition. I mean, these are all these Westerns that were made in the 90s and in this decade are really owe a lot to McCabe and Mrs. Miller. There's no denying it. And not only that, just a lot. There's a lot of great American independent films that are not Westerns that owe some. I think the influence of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, what we did earlier this year, is that film. It is just, I can see that film in a lot of other films in the last couple of years, and it's a very important film, and it's not important because we say it's important. It's important because it's just the language of the film speaks for itself.
Yeah, but also, that's from the Western end. But also, you think you're going to get a war movie, and you walk into MASH, which MASH was actually a audience success. It's not your typical war film, and for the first big movie out of the gate, speaking of bravery, for him to approach it this way, to comment on Vietnam before anyone did, through the guise of the Korean conflict, very shrewd and very smart movie.
Incredibly smart.
Mitchell spoke to it there when he said the only shot fired in the film was for the game. You know, it's revolutionary. It turns that genre on its head.
Yeah. Now, you know, you say it is the first film to really comment on Vietnam, it's 1970, and to use the Korean War, because the only other movie I can think of really before that, and that sort of comments on Vietnam, but this the commentary would come much later, is The Wild Bunch, was sort of an allegory for Vietnam. But that didn't really, I noticed that didn't come out until later in the 70s, when people had a greater appreciation for that film. But you're absolutely right, MASH is the first film that really does go after Vietnam. It certainly isn't the Green Berets, that's for sure. I know people that love that film, and I'm just like, why? I don't normally say that, but they're just like, it's such a great movie. I'm like, no, it's not. It's an insultingly bad movie.
Well, I think at the time of its release, at the time it was made, I think we're living in a very different time now.
Yeah.
We're living in a very politically cynical time now, and for good reason.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing that movie through those eyes.
Oh yeah, no. But even at the time, I took a course in college on Vietnam and the movies about the Vietnam War, and that film is just derided as just awful jingoistic propaganda. But
yeah.
But you talk about cynical, and I really do believe this about Altman, is I don't think there's a cynical bone in his body in his films. I don't think he's ever really true. I think he just presents it as it is. You're a fly on the wall, and that's it. I don't think he's ever passing judgment on his characters one way or the other.
Yeah.
And that may be a naive view on my part after all these years, but I honestly don't think he's cynical. There's a lot of cynicism, as I said, that comes to light in the 90s with other filmmakers, but not with him.
Bravery with music choices. I mean, using, and when they worked, I mean, they transported you using Leonard Cohen and McCabe, his music and McCabe, using one John Williams, I believe it was his theme. He just used it for the whole entire score of The Long Goodbye. It was one piece of music that scored that movie and all these different variations. And, you know, his latter work, The Player is a biting film.
Well, The Player is where he sort of has his revenge on everyone and everything, because is it Vincent and Theo is the film before that?
Yeah, I think so.
And, you know, it's really interesting with Vincent and Theo. You could make an argument that the 1990 was the year of the Mavericks, too. Coppola, De Palma, Scorsese, Altman, all these great directors had these big films coming out in the fall, Christmas season. And, you know, Altman was sort of, you know, almost an afterthought with all of those when he released Vincent and Theo. But The Player is like sweet revenge for him and puts him back in the game. And the film after The Player, Shortcuts, I think is his masterpiece. I'm also partial to The Gingerbread Man.
I am too.
I really like that film a lot. I think it's a great thriller, and it also is like that, the overlapping dialogue and everything, but it's everyone's really at the top of their game in that film. I like
And the studio really soiled on that film.
Oh, soiled? That's putting it very kindly, Jamie.
Yeah, but even so, even with what he did with the film, you think you're getting a John Grisham thriller, and you get a Robert Altman film. That's unmistakably Robert Altman.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing. And even the diabolical kind of sense of humor that he had in some of these films. And we talked about the contradictory nature of the man. There's a lot of comedy that comes from that, too, if you think about the opening of The Player.
Yeah.
When he shoots that unbroken dolly shot going weaving in and out of these different characters.
Yeah.
And at the same time, within that scene, I think it's Fred Ward's character that starts complaining about those shots or something.
Yeah.
Or talking about Touch of Evil, maybe. He's commenting on Touch of Evils.
Let me ask you about another movie that at the time it came out, there was a lot of fanfare. I like Cookie's Fortune, by the way. I'm a big fan of that film. I like that. But the film, I think it's in fall of 2000, Dr. T and the Women.
Yeah.
What is the consensus on that film?
I think it was well received.
Yeah, I remember writing a review for that for the Washington DC Film Society website, and I enjoyed it. I didn't hate, I know a lot of people look back on it, don't like it, but I enjoyed it for what it was. I really did.
of course, Pauline Kael was a major advocate of Robert Altman.
Oh, yeah.
And really, a lot of, she praised McCabe to the heavens, deservedly so. And then I remember one of the controversies in her career when she published a review of Nashville before it was finished, really. I think there was another edit to go on it.
Right.
And she published an advanced review, and everyone got kind of testy about it. And it forced that movie into the culture before it had been released. I think they released it early based on that review.
Right. I think you're right.
Yeah, she claimed it was an epic portrait of America. And she also made a statement in reading her reviews of his work that he's the most uneven director that she knows of, because he'd make a gem of a movie, and then he'd make a failure of a movie, and
right.
he'd just go back and forth throughout his entire throughout his career.
Right.
One for the Time Vault, and one that didn't take her very. She wasn't taken by at all. So we got some stuff in here. People like Popeye, The Long Goodbye, saying that Popeye was actually one of their favorite Altman movies.
Well, it's not a... Look, come on, I'm 10 years old. I'm in fifth grade. My mom is waiting with me all morning to get tickets, okay, at the movie theater, okay? We're
right.
waiting in line. It's this long line. And, you know, it's... You know, you can look back at it with film snobbery tears if you want, but I'm not. It was a lot of fun. It was Robin Williams from Mork and Mindy or from Happy Days, and I loved it. I mean, I really thought it was hysterical. I'm not going to lie and say, oh, it wasn't good, it was horrible. You know, no, it was a lot of fun.
It is interesting, too, because that was one of the few, as tough as that production was, and you get a good appreciation of Robert Evans in this book as well.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Robert Evans is, you know, I don't think from the late 60s to the mid 80s, it's kind of impossible not to have Robert Evans somewhere, because he's like Harry Lime in The Third Man. He overshadows everything.
Well, he was very supportive of Altman, and
he
essentially said, and not all of his producers were, and he essentially said, you know, whatever Bob wants, I'm your co-collaborator. I'll do for you what I'll stick by you. So he praised Altman, where others kind of felt here and there that they tolerated Altman for his genius, while they didn't necessarily agree with his methods at first.
No, that's true.
And maybe they were turned by the final product.
Mm-hmm.
But an amazing, and actually, we just spoke to cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond,
of
course shot great classic films, shot Spielberg's first theatrical feature, Sugarland Express, and Close Encounters, and he also shot McCabe and Mrs. Miller and The Long Goodbye, and I believe Images for Robert Altman.
Yeah,
and
he mentioned all those, actually.
Yeah, his interview will be on Wednesday night, the great Vilmos Zsigmond. Okay, you ready for our next guest?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let's do this. You guys might recall, I hope you recall, it was just last week, we discussed a terrific new horror film called Forget Me Not with the film's makers, Tyler Oliver and Jameson Stern. And tonight, we are pleased to welcome two stars of that film. Carly Schroeder's credits include TV series like Lizzie McGuire, Ghost Whisperer, and Law & Order Special Victims Unit, and big screen efforts like Mean Creek, Firewall, and Gracie. Micah Alberti's work includes CSI Miami, Beer for My Horses, and a long-running stint on the hit TV series Wildfire. And this is a great movie. It's actually premiering Screamfest LA on October 22nd, and I raved about it last week, and I'll rave about it again this week. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show actors Micah Alberti and Carly Schroeder. Let me bring them up here on our switchboard. Hi, Carly and Micah, are you with us?
Hi.
We're here.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
And Carly, I take it that a happy birthday is in order today.
Thank
it's your birthday
you.
Today.
Yes, it is.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
You. Yep, I'm 19. I finally made it.
19. I can't even remember being 19. It's been so long. But it's so nice of you to join us on your special day, so we appreciate that. Before we get into Forget Me Not, let me get a sense from you both on what inspired you to join the acting profession to begin with. Michael, what were those inspirations for you?
Well, you know, I think it started for me as just a teacher. You know, I needed someone to sort of guide me and guide my curiosity. And I had found that in Northern Illinois University by the woman of by the name of Catherine Gately. And she just sort of, you know, lit a new fire under my tail. And I fell in love with the craft and how you just can constantly learn and engage yourself in many, many different characters.
Yeah. And Carly, how about you?
Well, I've actually been doing this since I was like 5 years old. I was on a soap opera for like 7 years. So, I mean, I've been doing this for as long as I can remember. And I'm not really quite sure what my inspiration was. I just enjoyed doing it. My parents were like, whatever, let her do her thing.
Yeah. Well, what do you get out of it? What do you find you enjoy most about it?
I like playing different characters. I like being somebody that I'm not. It's always fun to kind of, you know, get that side of you out. My parents always say, you know, oh, no, you don't you start acting like that. You take that to set. Play that in a character.
Were there inspirations you looked to in the acting world, Micah, certain actors that you gravitated towards?
You know, it's sort of a tough question. I've tried to really pinpoint it, you know, and say, oh, like that actor, that actor, that actor. You know, I think I really, what inspired me the most is sitting in the theater by myself. When I moved to New York when I was 16 years old, and I didn't really have any friends, let alone I didn't know anybody. So when I was there, I just knew that the movie theater was right down the road. So I would go to the movie theater, and I would just sit there and watch and let myself just dive into the stories of these movies that I'm watching. And I think that was the biggest inspiration of it all. It was the emotion I got out of these films that I saw, and I fell in love with that, and I think that's what really motivated me the most.
Yeah. And Carly, how about you?
Well, I would have to say that, like, I appreciate, like, every actor, and I think each actor has their own style. But, like, personally, I think I would, if I could, be as close to Reese Witherspoon as possible in, like, her acting sense and her, like, personal life sense. She keeps everything private. You know, she doesn't, you know, go around flaunting herself, and she's a phenomenal actress. So if I could be half as good as her, I would be thrilled.
Yeah. When you get a script like a Forget Me Not, I mean, you guys have worked extensively for a long time. What about this project spoke to you, Micah?
You know, I think I fell in love with Jamie and Tyler's passion for the script and the story. When I walked in the room and I met everybody, I didn't think about the character, I didn't think about, you know, the story or anything like that. I really fell in love with their passion for the story and how they told it to me. And I just knew that these were two guys that really were behind the script, they were behind the story, and they believed in who they hired. And I thought that was really, really important to me, and I saw their passion for how much they wanted to make this such a great project, and I fell in love with that, and I said, I want to work with these guys right away. So I was really happy.
And it avoids a lot of the cliches of this genre, and I talked about it last week. I mean, I found it very, very intelligent and very different and as I said, character-driven. Is that part of what attracted you as well, Carly?
Yes, definitely. I'd actually been wanting to do a horror film for a while, but each script that I had read just wasn't right. There was something about it that was missing an element, or the girl was, like, you know, the consistently whiny, you know, always screaming, kind of, like, you know, droning on, boring. And this one was, like, really, it was really exciting, and there was different elements to it, and there was a character arc, and, you know, there was actually something there to play. There was something there to work with, and I thought it was really... And even the creatures are just creepy. I mean, even when you were reading it, you knew it was going to be, like, totally awesome.
Yeah,
but I think that's what I like the most, too, is that the story it really threw you a lot of different curveballs. And you know, once you start thinking, like, oh, it's going to be like this, it all of a sudden, it spins. You hit a 180, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, didn't realize that was going to happen. So I really liked how they kept it away from cliche.
Definitely.
You talk about the creatures, and obviously the horror genre is known from an actor's standpoint being very intense. But I understand there's a lot of levity on a horror film set as well. Is that true?
Carly, you want to take that?
No, you go for it, Micah.
I think so. You know, I think I really liked that there was a good sense of leadership through Tyler and Jamie, and they both did a very good job of really honing in on each of our characters and allowing us to really grow and talk. And I believe they let you, Carly, and myself, they allowed you to sit down and talk about how they wanted to work different issues out. I remember one scene we had us doing. It took us forever to shoot the scene. Something wasn't right. It was that police scene, Carly, and they just took forever, and they rewrote it, and then finally they came up with, you know, an idea, and then we I think it was the last two shots are like, okay, that's it. But they really allowed us to work with each other, and it was a great group of effort. You know what I mean? And I think that was very, very, very fun to accomplish.
I think it's a good combination of a great director, great producers, great cinematographer, and then a cast that actually knew what they were doing.
That got comfortable with each other, too,
exactly.
I understand.
Exactly.
Carly, you guys spent time together.
Yeah, yeah. That was definitely important.
Yeah. So you did they give you a week or so? How did you guys get to know each other prior to shooting?
Well, we all kind of went to the beach. We all kind of had like a little beach day.
We all hung out, throw the frisbee, hung out, talked, and you just
burnt together.
Yeah, you got an opportunity to get outside the office, so to speak, and where you have to be, talk office talk. You know what I mean? We got to go out on the beach and hang out and just be ourselves and really get to know each other, outside of the whole acting world, and I think that was very important to really establish solid relationships.
Yeah, how did you know, or maybe you didn't until you finally saw it, but when you're in a movie like this, how do you know when it's working? I want both of your takes on that. Carly, if you want to start.
How do you know when it's working?
Well, yeah, how do you know when what you're trying to convey is coming through?
That's a tough question. I mean, I guess you don't really know for sure, but I mean, There was times when you could like kind of tell that it was really creeping like everybody out, because when they called cut, everybody would just be staring at you like, what just happened? Or everybody would be like all huddled behind the monitor, and you'd see Tyler jumping up and down, and Jamie would be like peeking between his fingers. He'd be like, oh gosh, oh no. So I mean, there were times like that when you could feel that it was gonna work out right, but other times you're just hoping that everything just came together correctly.
Yeah. Micah, did you get a sense of when it was working?
That's sort of a tough question, because I have a lot of control issues. So when it comes to putting stuff on tape, I'm always like, okay, did that turn out? Did the point come across? Did this emotion come across? I'm very curious, and I think it's like any relationship. There has to be trust between the director, the writer, and the actor. And, if the director's point, you would hope the director has your best interest in mind and the interest of the story in mind. So when you're working through things and you have questions, a lot of directors, they like to be on their own page, but a lot of them are very open for criticism or just to help the actor understand the scene or the story a little bit more. And I think you just have to basically trust that director and trust that he has the story's best interest in mind. And you just have to trust that. And you have to trust that he's going to ask the proper things, ask you the proper things to get, that emotion or that, to finish up the scene correctly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And in this project, what was the biggest challenge for you? What are you proudest of concerning this project, Micah?
I'm really overall. I think Jamie and Tyler did a great job of sort of making my character a little bit more stronger in that sense. I come across as a very likable person. And some of that, they wanted none of that when it came to the script. He is a likable character, but he's a little bit harder. He's more quiet. He's sort of the leader of the group, and they really wanted him to really push that as much as he can. I think I was able to do that, and I think I was really proud of myself and proud of Jamie and Tyler for sort of pointing him in that direction. I think they did a great job, and it turned out.
Yeah. And Carly, how about you?
Well, I'd have to say, like, one of the things that I'm most proud of is, like, the actual movie, like, as a whole. I think that when you watch it all the way through, like, I went and saw it, there was a screening for it, and I sat next to Brie, who is one of the leading girls in it, and we sat there, and we were terrified, and we even knew what was coming next. Like, we were sitting there squealing in the front row and, like, laughing and giggling and, you know, seeing the memories as it went by and everything. I think the overall movie is very impressive, and I was very thrilled with it.
So you guys have both seen it, obviously,
yeah,
with an audience?
Sort of an audience.
It was like an audience that's already, like, seen it. It was, like, cast and crew.
Because
yeah,
these kinds of movies, they thrive on the audience. So
yeah.
I'm looking at this upcoming premiere that you guys have,
mm-hmm,
October 22nd, as part of Scream Fest LA. It's going to be at Man's Chinese Theater, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep,
this, you guys have to both be really thrilled about this event.
Well, I have to be honest with you. You know, at first, you know, we never saw dailies. We never got to, you know, we only heard from Tyler or Jamie, oh, it's good, it's good, it's good. Everybody likes it. So you're like, okay. All right. Of course you like it, but let's, you know, we haven't seen anything. So until that first screener, we were definitely, I guess I can only speak for myself, but I was very nervous, you know, because you're with all the characters and the way, you know, the acting, and you just never know how it's going to turn out. And you know, I was very surprised at how it turned out, and I'm actually very excited to let the public see it. And, you know, my parents are coming, and I'm excited for them to see it. And you know, it's pretty exciting, and I'm very, very excited for it to come out.
Yeah, and what a great venue for it too, Carly. You got to be thrilled as well about it.
I am. I'm very excited. I can't wait to just, like, I know what the movie looks like now. Now I'm watching it to see the reactions of everyone else. That's
mm-hmm.
going to be the most exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Watching my parents squeal, watching my friends squeal. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
I hope I see some tears.
the movie is Forget Me Not, and it is fantastic. It world premieres on the 22nd as part of Scream Fest LA. That's a Thursday night, I believe. What's upcoming for you guys? Michael, what you got coming up?
At the moment, just auditioning, trying to keep it busy, you know, pounding the pavement, so they say.
Yeah. Tell me about the auditioning process. Is that, it doesn't seem like it's designed to bring out an actor's best. I mean,
you know, it's interesting game. You know, it when you book the project and the auditioning process, it's two different games. You know, one game is, you know, cracking down, studying, and getting ready for the audition. And then, you know, if you get it, then it's a whole different game. It's studying for that job and getting ready for the job. So
mm-hmm.
the audition process, you know, you can have anywhere from 1 to 5 to 6 auditions a week. And you find yourself, you know, reading scripts, reading sides, trying to memorize, trying to work on your moments, your beats. And, you know, it can be a little overwhelming. But, you know, it certainly is a challenge, and it's definitely a interesting battle, that's for sure. But you know, when you do book jobs and when things come out, you know, you're excited to work on that character, and you're very excited to build relationships and to start for that new challenge. So it's a fun little game, I guess.
Yeah, and Carly, what's coming up for you?
Well, currently I'm just chilling in the dorm right now with the guys in room 215.
Having a birthday party. That's right.
Yeah, gonna get some birthday cake. But other than that, I'm auditioning a little bit here and there. But I'm actually a student in college. It's my first year, so I'm pretty excited about that too.
Wow.
What are you
studying in college?
Well, I have a minor in theater, and then I'm doing a double major in communications and psychology.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
And I just found out I'm homecoming princess, so I'm, like, super stoked. Today's my day.
It's a great day for you.
Yeah, it is fantastic.
Well, don't you have a film coming out? It's coming out on DVD next week. It's a project with Christine Lottie. Did I read that right?
I don't know if that's me. Could be.
I'm so sorry. I think it was a TV film that's coming out on DVD next week.
Mm. Oh, is it Prayers for Bobby?
That's it.
That's it.
I knew you'd
yes.
come up with it.
Yes, with Sigourney Weaver, yes. I was like, I don't know. It could be.
Well, I really appreciate both of you guys joining me tonight. And I think the movie's fantastic, and you're both great in it. And I wish
you
the best
you.
Of luck with it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you, guys. Happy birthday, Carly.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Okay, that is Carly Schroeder and Micah Alberti. The movie is Forget Me Not. Jerry, I'm bringing you back on.
Okay.
I'm so sorry, man. You're clicking.
No, that's all right. I understand that. You know, I'm willing to make that sacrifice. So that was cool, though. I mean, I was happy. It was her birthday. She was in the dorm. She's having a good time, and it's homecoming.
I'm sorry that your phone was clicking, man. I was going to have you sing happy birthday.
No, that's probably better that we didn't. We want to stay on the air.
That would have been the ultimate gift to her.
I think she would have hung up immediately.
I remember that film Mean Creek years ago.
Yeah, no, Mean Creek's a good film. I remember watching it a couple of years ago. I like that movie a lot.
It was like The River's Edge for a new generation.
It was. There's no doubt about that.
We're going to hang on the phone for a little bit longer because I'm not sure, but fellow movie geek Chris might join us in a couple of minutes. I told him to call in 20 after the hour if he felt so inclined. So let's comb through some movies conversation before.
Okay, what do you want to talk about?
Before he may or may not call in. Okay. I saw Paranormal Activity.
Okay, I want to hear your thoughts on it.
Okay. As everyone out there knows, we spoke to the filmmaker, Oren Peli, on Wednesday night concerning Paranormal Activity. This is a real breakthrough for him, this movie, and it's caught on like no other film this year. You know, I was expecting it to have opened in more theaters. It only opened in 790 theaters this weekend. I thought we were talking about a 2,000
That's what I thought, too, the way we were talking the other night. So,
And had it released in 2,000 screens, I think it would have swallowed everything.
Oh,
including
yeah.
including where the wild things are.
I think you may be right on that. I think you have a case to be made there.
So the question is about the main question I had was whether or not the film will be viewed as a gimmick film years from now.
It's hard to say.
I don't know. And you already talked about some backlash on this movie. Which always happens when people take to a movie like they have to this one. There's always the naysayers that say, you know, you're crazy. The movie isn't scary. I think they're disingenuous. The movie works, and I was in a crowded theater, and I think that certainly helps. But the reaction was off the charts in the theater. I've never heard people scream in the movie theater like they did at this screening.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah,
will it work well at home when you're watching it by yourself? I think it might. I think it might because the film is set in the home. I mean, it's a very intimate movie set mostly in.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I this film. I mean, you're watching this by yourself. I think the second half of the film is going to scare you shitless.
Yeah,
I really do. I don't care who you are. It's very frightening at times.
It is very frightening, and I didn't find the camera to be a gimmick. First of all, you don't get nauseous watching it because for the most part the camera is static. It's set up on a tripod in the room, and that's also something. The scary moments in the film, it's very static. It's one single shot. And unencumbered by camera moves or any of that. Another thing that really excited me about the movie was people were screaming, people were reacting in a very visceral way to a door closing, to a sound, to a shadow. They weren't reacting that way to some ultra-gory mess, you know?
No, that's what made it so incredible. And then, like we were talking earlier about it, it was just the things going on the screen and more so what you couldn't see. It's just the sound. It's like the ultimate case of the sound is so frightening, and everyone's like, holy shit, people are screaming during the film.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really scared.
I think it'll take its place as one of the great ghost stories, ghost movies, paranormal movies, however you want to term it. Now, there was one moment in particular that I won't give away. It's not the ending, but it's in the last third of the movie that I felt it. I mean, I felt it in the pit of my stomach, and I didn't scream. I laughed out loud. And I looked
right.
over at my brother, and I was like, man, I love this. This is awesome. But, you know, it was a moment of great energy in that theater. I won't give away what it is. But that being said, there were two moments that I felt were cheats, and they both were the same thing. They both were a smile from the lead character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. But,
I do know what you're talking about.
It was too on the nose. It detracted from the realism of it, and it was going for an obvious effect that I kind of groaned at. Outside of that, I think the movie is perfect the way it is. I think the two actors are fantastic.
They really are.
They're great. They're great, and she is wonderful too.
I don't know if this is appropriate, and I hope Lynn Shelton doesn't mind me saying this, but it's like the hump day of horror films. And I love hump day. I went to go see that after we talked to her, you know, that Friday when it opened near me, and I loved hump day. I thought it was just an incredible film, but that was what I kept thinking of because of the chemistry between the lead actors in that film and in this film. It was like that's what it reminded me of, and I mean that in the highest praise that I can give both films, that they had that kind of feel to it. And
the hump day of horror films, that'll be on their poster, I think.
I hope not, because I can just see Lynn Shelton deleting me from Facebook right now. But I loved hump day. I thought hump day was incredible. But
well, for a lot of people here in the South, hump day is a horror film.
Okay.
Let me bring on Chris. Chris is here. We haven't talked to him on the show in weeks. Chris, my friend, my newly married friend.
Congratulations, Chris.
Hey, thank you.
So I know if it's my problem or not, and then I'll patch these guys back in. Because, Chris, I can't hear you. If you can call back in, that would be great. Okay, Jerry's calling back in.
Yeah, I call back in. That's the third time that's happened today. So
I know. It happened with Vilmos, with
me. Yeah,
I
know.
Chris, can you hear us? Because we cannot hear Chris. I think Chris needs to reconnect his phone call. Sorry, man. If you can hear us, hang up and call back in. Oh, he's calling back in.
All right, cool.
Chris?
Hey, what's up?
I'm sorry, man. That was anticlimactic.
Yeah, it really was.
I assumed it was after I got cut off. I don't know what happened, but...
it's not you. It's them.
It's the switchboard today. It's screwy. So you just got married. You're a newlywed.
Yes. Yes, I am.
How's it feel to be a... one of us, one of the geeks, with an actual wife?
It feels pretty good. It feels a little bit less geeky, but believe me, I still get made fun of on a regular basis. Within the last couple hours, I was made fun of for being a movie geek. So,
okay. Well, good.
Okay,
you're still one of us.
Some things don't change.
No. I constantly get made fun of for it. It'll never end. I'll always be a movie geek, whether I have a ring on my finger or not.
Yeah, there you go.
But are you liking it? How's this first, what has it been, 2 weeks now? 15 days?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so like 2 weeks ago we got married, yeah. It's been great. I love it. We had a great wedding, a great reception, a great honeymoon. Everything went perfectly. So, it's been going really nice, you know. What can I say? We're married. We're doing a lot of newlywed fucking, and
There you go. You just have to.
If that's what you want to hear, that's what's going on.
Well, that's this kind of show. I'm glad to see that at least, Chris, you have not forgotten the spirit of what the show is all about.
Oh, that's
you
how
know,
we do it here. Wetting House, yeah.
The Wetting House.
We're trying to make a little movie geek here.
Well, enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see Where the Wild Things Are this weekend, Chris? I know Jerry probably did, but did you see it, Chris?
Unfortunately, no, I didn't get to go see it. I was catching up on an older movie that I wanted to see. I went to see Capitalism, a love story, but didn't get to squeeze in Wild Thing.
Well, let me hear what you thought of Capitalism.
Yeah, I want to hear that, too.
I loved Capitalism, a love story. I thought it was right in line with the best of Michael Moore's work. You know what you're getting when you go see a Michael Moore movie, and I don't think he's made a movie that didn't deliver in the way that only he can. I mean, it's not a perfect movie, just like none of his movies are perfect. I think Bowling for Columbine was about as perfect as it gets for him.
Right.
But this movie belongs in that same conversation. The problem I have with Michael Moore is not... He's always basically telling the stories of victims and perpetrators, and no one tells the story of the perpetrators as well as he does. I don't always feel like he tells the victim story as two-sided as he absolutely could. I feel like that's where his weak point is when he's making movies. Some of the stories that he tells of people that were affected by things that have happened, maybe there's a little bit more to that story. Paints them to be a little bit more victimized. They had a hand in what was going on. But having said that, that is only a minor complaint, and only a complaint that I had a few brief moments in the movie. For the most part, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was informative and entertaining and hilarious in a way that only he makes. No one else is making documentaries that are as hilarious as his are. He really is a really, really funny and intelligent guy.
Without a doubt.
And I really do think that he is kind of one of the few filmmakers we have who's kind of a hero, really. Like, he tackles stories that most people won't tackle and certainly would not tackle in the way that he does, and he's always on the forefront of these stories. He always gets his movie out at the right time. You know, this movie, we'll probably see lots more documentaries about this topic, but... He, once again, was first. He was first with the Bowling for Columbine movie, which was timely and topical, likewise for Fahrenheit, Sicko, and this one, too. I will always go see Michael Moore movies because they're always, you know, like, they always deliver. And this one is no exception.
This is, I think, personally, this is his best one since Bowling. Because this is an important... where the story he's telling is sort of encompasses everything from Roger and me up to this. Let's be very honest. This is
about
our livelihoods, really.
He's good at sort of, because especially with this topic, but he did it with Sicko very well, too. He's good at taking a topic that is very convoluted and very difficult to get your mind around all the pieces. He's able to take all those things and not only explain them and put them into a pill that's easy to swallow over the course of 2 hours, but he's also able to do it and make it extremely entertaining and hilarious. His use of music is always fantastic.
Yeah, that's his true here.
Have
without doubt.
These great ironic flourishes to them. He's really not only a good filmmaker, but I do think really a hero filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Really one of the most underrated and important filmmakers of our time. Whether you agree with his politics or not, he's tackling these subjects and doing it well.
Yeah.
He's an extraordinary filmmaker.
Let me ask you, because you bring up Sicko, and Sicko is a really great film. I mean, it's just an incredibly powerful film, and this one is too. And I just feel like not enough people are going to see them. These last two are really about the two most important issues of our time, healthcare and our finances, our livelihood, if you will. And it's just like, not enough people are getting after to see him, and this last one is really the one to see, because he's basically at the end of Capitalism. He's saying, I need your help.
It's true. You know, it's funny, but in a way, he would be better served to make these movies if there was a television network or a cable channel that had the balls to do it. He would be better served to make these movies for a channel like that, actually, if he wanted to get that message out. But I think ultimately it does get out, and I think ultimately people do rent these movies more than they watch them in the theater. I think that's kind of the thing. And, you know, I mean, look at Bowling for Columbine. What other documentaries can you name that came out that year that we're still talking about? Very, very few. Certainly not any that the public remembers. And you could say the same thing for Fahrenheit 9/11. And ultimately, I think we'll say the same thing about Sicko and capitalism. It's just that not enough time has passed. I don't think those movies are going to go away the way that other documentaries do.
Oh,
I think they're going to stick around for a long time.
I hope not, Chris. I hope, and especially about Sicko, because there's a lot of things in Sicko that I you know, it's kind of like you wanted to in August of this year, you wanted to show Sicko to all these people who were so against health care reform. You just like wanted to say, why don't you go rent Sicko? Before you
yeah.
say anything, go rent
and
Sicko,
I,
because you're not doing yourself any favors.
Yeah, I don't think that you can really fault him or even the production company for these movies not performing very well. I think there's a ceiling on these kind of movies, and I think he hits it every time. Sometimes more than others, but there's no season that you could release Sicko in where it would have performed better than it did. And
right.
Likewise for Capitalism. I mean, this is arguably, you know, the best time. Although he could release it any time, and it would make about the same amount of money.
He has a core audience that will
The core audience will go to see it. The intellectuals go to see it. Certainly the liberal intellectuals go to see it. And everybody else will sort of discover it on DVD. And I think he understands that.
Yeah.
We don't expect these movies to, you know, to be taking on Couples Retreat or whatever. Like, it was
no
surprise.
Not even Couples. Forget Couples Retreat. I mean, you're asking, you know what the sad thing is, Chris? The DVD or the cable, whatever the secondary market is that you want to use, is where it's really going to have the impact. The sad thing is, though, and you see this with some of the more serious movies, some of the serious comedies, if you will, dramedies that came out this year, people just don't want to see them. Not immediately. They want to see Paul Blart more than they want to see anything else.
Yeah.
I understand that from a certain angle.
That's not going to change. And you know that. I mean, it's not going to change.
Yeah.
But in time, we will not, 10 years from now, if you go into Blockbuster, first of all, you won't be able to walk into a Blockbuster in 10 years.
No, I don't think so. I think that's a foregone conclusion.
But in a hypothetical future where video stores still existed, you know, video stores only really, like, 95% of their product is things that have come out in the last 5 years. They really don't keep a lot of older movies. You know, if you go into Blockbuster right now, 95% of the things they have is from the 2000s, and an even smaller amount from that. You can find very few movies from the 90s. You know, the big ones, you'll find Independence Day, you'll find Mrs. Doubtfire. Go back to the 80s, you'll find even fewer titles. When you get to the 70s and 60s, you're talking about under 100 titles that they have in their store.
That's very true.
And this is one of those, these, as far as the documentary genre goes, his movies will be the ones in 20, 30 years that you will still be able to find. You will not be able to find Trekkies, you know, you won't be able to find some of these smaller documentaries that can be very good. They just won't last the way that his movies will, because there's that filmmaking style of his is so good, and I think is a little bit ahead of its time. I think, and it was ahead of its time. He was doing this first with Roger and Me, and now you see lots of people doing this sort of thing, and it'll stick around. We'll be able to find these movies for a long time.
Right? Yeah.
People will be watching them.
And I think he's very prescient, and the fact that Roger and Me still resonates today based on current goings on. I mean, it's both good for – it speaks well of him as a filmmaker and poorly of us as a country that it does.
Yeah.
And I think he's already stated that this could be the last documentary he makes. I don't know that I'll take that very seriously. I think this is his identity. I think he might try to do a narrative feature again, but I think he'll be – continuously drawn back to what he does best.
I agree.
Where the wild things are, Jerry.
I'm going to just tell you, I went on the midnight show to see it with my mom, and then I took my brother to see it on Friday. Two very different reactions to the film. How do you say this? It's brilliant and everything that you've heard, but it's not that. It's a different kind of film. It's not what you would expect. I mean, the trailer is very joyous, very wonderful, very magical trailer. It's a different film from the trailer, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in even a better way. I don't think I've ever seen something as introspective and something as accurate on childhood. It's the most accurate thing on childhood I've seen since E.T.
Wow.
I mean, in the first 20 minutes of the film are painfully brilliant. The most accurate depiction I've seen of childhood put on screen since E.T., without a doubt. When we get to the island, the monsters and all that, It's incredible. It's a film that we'll be reckoned with for a long time, for many years to come. We're talking about things that have a long shelf life. This will have a very long shelf life.
You know what, though? We're talking about it with Altman, where you go into an Altman movie, you think you're going to get a typical Western, and you don't. Blah, 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 and that goes across the genres that Altman dealt with. That's where I think the comparison between Spike Jonze and Altman exists. That's why I think I'm expecting a major drop in the second weekend, because families are coming in expecting one thing, and they're not given the usual menu with the Spike Jonze film, which is
a great thing
for us. But
it's a family film, but it is not a children's movie. It is an all-ages film. But I don't know how little kids will react to this film. If I was if I was below 10 years old, I can't say I would be really that interested in it. But
yeah.
Now that's not I understand that from a little kid's perspective, but as an adult looking back on childhood, it's potent. It's a tonic. It's a potent tonic.
A potent tonic.
It is something that you will. I don't know how to describe it. If your parents read the book to you as a kid, it's powerful. It's powerful stuff.
Well, first of all, the book is only what? I mean, it's 9 sentences or something.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's very small amount of text.
It's a picture book from 1963, and that's another thing. It's amazing what. Now, Dave Eggers wrote a book, to go along with this. I don't know if that was necessary or not, but what they were able to get out to make a feature-length movie is incredible.
Yeah.
It's astounding what they were able to.
Let me take this phone call real quick, because we might get another review here, if I'm correct about who this is. And then I want to talk about some movie stories with you guys before we sign off. Got a call here. Is this Roland by chance?
Yeah. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Roland,
how's
going on, brother?
Hey, Jerry.
How you doing, man? You're there in London?
I am, yeah.
And you've attended some screenings of the film festival there?
Yeah, I've been at the London Film Festival the last 3 or 4 days. I've seen 3 premieres so far.
All right, tell us about them.
I saw The Men Who Stare at Goats. Has anyone seen that yet?
No,
not yet.
I read the book
no.
a long time ago.
Okay. I fell asleep during that one.
I heard it's awful.
I thought it was terrible. Clooney was there, presenting it and everything. But
did you tell Clooney it was awful? Did you go up to George? Did you say George? You know, George, this really sucked.
I tell you what, from his demeanor, the way he kind of, you could tell he was just there doing his job, And then I saw The Road.
Now, how was The Road?
That was interesting. That was... What have you guys heard about that?
I've heard it's awful.
Okay.
I've heard very mixed.
I've heard, though, it's really... The reviews I've read are really... I think the book is wonderful, and the director, John Hilko, that made the proposition, he's, I would think, the perfect director for the material.
Yeah. I thought the direction was excellent. I thought the acting was excellent. I thought the cinematography was amazing. But the script, the story, it drags. I mean, there's just no story there. It's set in the future. It's set in the future. You don't know. Everything's dead. You don't know what...
10 years, I think, from now is the time frame they give us.
Okay. You don't know if it's like a nuclear war or if it's global warming or something, but
specify what the actual event was. It was something cataclysmic, but he wouldn't specify. He never would specify what the event was.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Essentially, it's Viggo Mortensen and his son trying to survive and not get eaten. But the levels of... they throw a few areas of tension there where they're being chased by these, cannonballs, Mad Max kind of characters, but they're few and far between.
Is that the problem with the film? You're reminded of The Road Warrior too much?
Not really. It's just fleeting moments of tension. I don't think it's a bad film. I think the cinematography is amazing. I just don't think there's enough going on.
Right.
Do you prefer it over I Am Legend?
I Am Legend. Yes, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well. All right.
Well, that's
yeah.
that's a glowing recommendation.
Right there.
Yeah. The other film that I saw last night was a film called 44 Inch Chest, which is a British movie.
Oh, Jonathan Glazer's new film.
Yeah. No, not his new movie.
It's got oh God, Ray Winstone, right?
That's right. It's the writer that did Sexy Beast.
You're right. Okay.
So I thought that would be interesting, but it had a great cast. Got Ian McShane, Ray Winston, Stephen Delaney, Tom Wilkinson, and John Hurt. It's kind of a weird movie. It's kind of an art house gangster flick.
Yeah.
And that didn't really work either. Tomorrow I'm seeing the premiere of Bright Star, which I know is already out in the States, so it's kind of weird.
Now, 44-inch chest, does that refer to a woman?
Yeah, it's basically about Ray Winston's character finds out that his wife has been cheating on him, so him and his cronies go out and find this sort of young buck that's been screwing his wife, and they torture him, and it's basically a process where Winston's trying to decide what to do with this kid.
Okay.
All right.
And that's basically, yeah, the whole movie is set in one room.
I didn't know that was done yet. I still thought they were making that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a weird film. The whole movie is set in one room, really.
So tell me about the festival itself. Are people... I've never been overseas. I don't know their take on films. Is there a palpable excitement about movies there? Are they kind of reserved about them?
No, very much. I mean, pretty similar to the States, really. I'd say living in the States, the American-going cinema audience is probably the most passionate about films. It's kind of more of a cultural thing that people will go to the movies in the States every weekend. But next to that, I'd say Britain is not too far away from that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and certainly at the London Film Festival, yeah, I mean the attendances are good. It's, you got to say outside LA and, I would say London's probably the next biggest city for movies, maybe with New York. You know, as far as things being made and
right.
and clout within the industry as such.
Right. Do you get a sense of what the buzz is all about? What film they're buzzing most about there?
Probably, what's the Mr. Fantastic Fox, whatever it's called?
Oh, the Wes Anderson film, The Fantastic Fox, okay.
Yeah, that seems to be getting a lot. The other Clooney movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that called?
Oh, Up in the Air?
Up in the Air, yeah.
That's getting all the buzz here, so, I mean, and everywhere, and every festival, so.
Doesn't Clooney do a voice in the Fantastic Mr. Fox,
yes,
too?
He
does, yeah.
Mr. Fox.
That dude's all over the place.
Yeah.
He's
staring at goats, he's a fox, and he's up in the air, you know?
Yeah.
He's a fox up in the air staring at goats.
Yeah.
There you go.
It was interesting to hear what kind of figures Where the Wild Things Are did this weekend in the States, though.
It did very well.
Did.
We're just discussing that.
Yeah. I mean, but I think Jamie's right. It might have a very big drop off next weekend.
Definitely.
I mean, it's not the kind of film that, you know, the sad thing, it's just not, you know, remember, this is a film that was shut down for a while because when they showed them the initial footage, the people at the studio were just like, what the hell are you doing? You know, because it's a hard thing to bring to life. And it is one of those. It's one of those books, one of those stories that everyone brings their own baggage to it. But I think this is the best way you could have done it. In the '90s, I would have said Terry Gilliam or Tim Burton. In this decade, Spike Jonze, and the other only director I think who could really pull this off is Michel Gondry. Otherwise, forget it. Don't touch it.
Mm. Yeah. Did Terry Gilliam's movie come out in the States yet?
No. It's been. I know people have seen it at festivals, but it hasn't been officially released.
Oh, it came out here on Friday. But no one seems to be paying too much attention to it.
When are you coming back to the States, man?
Yeah,
probably a few weeks.
All right.
A few weeks. Well, when you get back to the States, give us a call again and tell us what else you've seen.
Yeah.
I know you're calling from overseas, so I don't want to keep you very long. But
Definitely.
I wanted to hear the buzz on. I wanted to hear your word on these great films that you've seen. Well, not great films, obviously. You weren't very impressed by them.
Yeah, really. I'm sure 44-inch chest isn't that great, you know?
No.
44-inch chest sounds like a John Waters movie, actually.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it so much, Roland, as always. You're awesome.
Thank you,
bye, guys. Take care.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's some big news this week, guys. Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's new movie. It is definitely not a 2009 release. We know that for sure now.
Yeah, I
could
have figured that out, yeah.
But there was mystery about it. So it's out of Oscar contention. Chris, what's the sense you get about Tree of Life? Because you hear it's a story of an intimate family story with dinosaurs in the 1950s or something, with dinosaurs thrown in.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's big news that it's not coming out in 2009, but it's not. I don't think it's surprising news to anybody.
Right.
I like Terrence Malick's movies, and I know that it'll be good. I don't know about this dinosaur thing. Like, you know, I think that that will probably be a minor moment. I don't think that that's going to be some like the centerpiece of the movie. I have no idea the context that the dinosaur part plays in it.
Yeah, really. And where did you get this dinosaur part from, man?
Oh, the dinosaurs have been in the press about it for over a year.
Yeah.
ILM says that they're working on dinosaurs for the film.
Terrence Malick doing dinosaurs? I mean, that's just like, God, I feel like, you know, I've woken up in a parallel universe. This is awesome. Okay.
Well, it speaks to me that this is going to be an extra helping of the metaphysical from Terrence Malick, and there's always elements of that, and it's what kept me so distanced from the Thin Red Line. And yet, there was a sense of it in something like a Badlands or Days of Heaven or a New World that didn't distance me from it. But
you were distanced, though, and a lot of people were, though, distanced from the Thin Red Line.
That's the sense I get from it. And another thing, tell me about this Kenneth Branagh's Thor, because it's surprising to me for a couple of reasons. It's obviously a big comic book property.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie that you'd spend a lot of money on.
Right.
Now, I love Kenneth Branagh, as I'm sure we all do, but wasn't it surprising to you that he was chosen to direct it? In spite of all of his accomplishments years ago.
Well, It makes sense. Here's the thing. All right, I'm going to nerd out here for a minute. But Thor, as a comic book, Thor was originally based in Norse mythology.
Yeah.
So to that end, it makes sense that Kenneth Branagh would be helming this property, because although he's not known necessarily for making movies about mythology or anything like that, it's material that it does seem suited to an intellectual, because there's lots of metaphor, and it's not necessarily just a story about, you know, a hulking giant who has superpowers. But with the comic books, they got away from that Norse mythology, and then Thor became like a human man, and from what I understand, that's the direction they're going with this screenplay. So to that end, it does not make sense that Kenneth Branagh would be helming it. You could get any guy to helm a movie like that.
Really?
The other upsetting thing about this is, we've seen this before with comic book movies in particular. I think that the director has a lot less involvement in how that product turns out than the studio does, Marvel in particular. I think that's where this movie could potentially go wrong.
I agree.
It's very intriguing, but comic book movies, unlike any other genre, like, you really have to wait and see the finished product, because it could absolutely go one way or the other. We've seen both. I mean, we've seen one filmmaker make a really good comic book movie and then turn around and make another comic book movie within the same series that was not very good at all. I'm talking about Sam Raimi with the Spider-Man movies, for instance. And when it went wrong, it was because of the studio's involvement. So this is really intriguing. Now it comes out that Robert De Niro might be involved in the thing. You know, of course, it has no major cast. The Robert De Niro thing has not been confirmed yet, but other than that, it really doesn't have a very strong cast.
Yeah, it's only got the guy who played Kirk's father in Star Trek is playing.
Right, and then, like, Natalie Portman plays, like, I guess the love interest or something, but Natalie Portman is not exactly, you know, like, a, I mean, she's a great actress, and she is a name, but that's not enough to sell a movie on. So it's really intriguing, but I feel like it's way too soon for us to make any sort of judgment about Kenneth Branagh. And also, I'm not convinced that Kenneth Branagh will continue to helm this thing. I would think so too. Like, and we've seen that before. There's numerous directors that have been involved with comic book properties that have not seen them to fruition, because I think the nature of the property has too many demands on it. There's too much expectation when it comes to a property like this.
Well, I need to add something here. There's a big problem, not a problem, but these films, and there's also a Captain America film, and it's like the Hulk film that followed Iron Man, and Iron Man was brilliant, and I hope the second Iron Man 2 is good, but they're all rushing these films in anticipation of the Avengers movie. So all these films are really just sort of a warm-up to this bigger movie. And I think there's gonna a lot of heads in the roll, a lot of heads are going to clash, because the Thor film, while it is important, it's only a stepping stone to something much larger. And I don't know if Kenneth Branagh really wants to be involved in that, to be honest with you.
Well, I saw a recent interview with Kenneth Branagh. He's a fascinating guy. He was on Charlie Rose for the hour, and they were talking, and he was very honest about the trajectory of his career. This is a guy that came out of the gate such a young age. Henry V, people compared him to Olivier, but I think more aptly to Orson Welles, in that he was so ambitious and his work was so dynamic as an actor and as a director and wearing all these hats as a writer. He was brave and brazen enough and egotistical enough to do some really massive projects, if you remember his four-and-a-half-hour Hamlet. And then he faltered, and he kind of disappeared. And he admitted, you know, it has a lot to do with ego. I mean, this is a guy that wrote his autobiography at the age of 30.
Right.
So when he was talking about himself, he was very honest about the trajectory of his career. And he ended off, he said, excuse me, he said, I'm working on Thor. I'm hard at work conceptualizing Thor right now. And they asked him about to describe the project, and he seemed to be definitely on board and excited about the project. If anything pulls him off of that project, I would think it would have to do with that control you guys are talking about, and maybe a little bit of ego thrown in.
I think you're absolutely right about that. But not only that, I also think that filmmakers who are sort of intellectual in nature do not do well with these kind of movies. And I don't mean to slight guys like Jon Favreau, because Jon Favreau made a good movie with Iron Man, and I think it was an intelligent movie, but it's not necessarily... Jon Favreau could never have made that four-hour Hamlet movie, and that four-hour Hamlet movie is brilliant, and it's an epic, and it's exactly the kind of movie that you would look at and say, he made this, I believe he could make Thor. But I don't think that the nature of that comic book property, I don't think it translates into an intellectual film. Look at what Ang Lee tried to do with The Hulk. Ang Lee is, first and foremost, an intellectual filmmaker. He makes movies with adult themes for adults, and he tried to have it both ways with The Hulk, and it doesn't work. I don't know that Kenneth Branagh knows how to make a movie that has it both ways. I think he will side, like Ang Lee, he will side a little bit too much on the intellectual side, and what the property will turn out to
be. Well, anyone that makes these kinds of movies, I think you're absolutely right, has to have their eye on what the audience wants. The most successful projects, comic book projects, are always directed in that vein.
Right.
Well, they were directed in that vein, but the most successful ones, the first two Spider-Man movies, the first two Superman movies, and especially the first two of the newer Batman movies and even the X-Men movies, you had directors who really respected the source material but also were willing to put their own spin on it. And as much as I admire Kenneth Branagh, I don't know if Thor demands anything that we've talked about, because it's such an odd property. They tried to make Thor into a one of the Incredible Hulk TV movies in the late 80s, and it failed miserably as translated onto film, onto screen. I don't know if Thor is translatable as a film. It's not, and that's not a failure on Kenneth Branagh's part. some of these properties, not everything that is a comic book needs to be made into a movie. We find this out every couple of years.
We found that out with the first Avengers.
I'm not sure Thor is comic, you know, is film adaptable. I just don't know if it's going to work.
Yeah, and also, let's not forget, like Jamie said, like, Branagh has been out of the game. And I do think that filmmaking is the kind of thing that you sort of kind of have to be on a roll. Anyway, that's usually how it works. You don't usually see someone who takes a break from filmmaking and then all of a sudden he comes back and he makes this dynamic movie that not only makes a dynamic movie, but makes a dynamic movie that's totally out of his comfort zone. Like, hard to come back. You know, Michael Jordan was a great basketball player. He couldn't come in today and play on a team against Kobe Bryant and win. He certainly couldn't come in today and play a totally different sport and win, you know, like,
right.
He's out of his game and quite literally out of his game if he's trying to do something that is not in his comfort zone. I think
right.
I really am worried about this project because I ultimately I don't think it stands much of a chance. And let's not forget, too, that Thor is not Spider-Man. Thor is not Batman. Thor is not Superman. Thor is sort of a second-tier character, and those second-tier superhero movies have definitely not worked, with the exception of Iron Man. In fact, I think Iron Man is the only one that has worked, and that is the exception to the rule. All of the second-tier superhero movies have been failures.
Yeah, I mean, look at Ghost Rider, look at Daredevil. I mean,
yeah.
They're not movies that have really worked.
I'd prefer not to look at those.
Well, I know you don't.
Ever again.
I realize that, but this is going to be more, I think, in a failure, because I think Marvel is just trying so hard to their reaching this goal. They're rushing these things out in the production, and when you rush something like this in the production, you know, if I can paraphrase Don Cheadle on Out of Sight, the common motherfucker can fuck up really badly. And when you're doing that, you know, there's a lot of room for mistakes, and I see that with these next several Marvel films outside of the Iron Man sequel. I see a potential for a great failure.
Also, you speak about Sam Raimi and Spider-Man. He says that the main problem with Spider-Man 3, and he recognizes it, is too many characters. And like you just verbalized, that was the one time that he listened to the studio and heeded their advice that they had to have Venom introduced. And that's what detracted from Spider-Man 3. So he vows for Spider-Man 4 to get back to the basics, whatever those basics are. Speaking of a sequel... they're now breaking that Judge Reinhold and John Ashton are probably attached to Beverly Hills Cop 4. So,
okay.
Yeah. I'm John Ashton and Judge Reinhold were in Beverly Hills Cop 2, and it wasn't very good. Judge Reinhold was in Beverly Hills Cop 3, and it wasn't very good. The problem is not that Taggart and Rosewood weren't in the movie.
There's only one reason why I mentioned this, Chris. It's because we feel somewhat responsible for opening the gates between Judge Reinhold and Brett Ratner. So I just wanted to brag on us a little bit.
Okay.
Well, don't get me wrong. I like Judge Reinhold in Beverly Hills Cop. I like John Ashton in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
It's just that I don't think this kind of product or property has legs. I don't think there's a desire to see it. I really don't. And I don't care who's making it, if it's Brett Ratner. And I'm not one of these people that hates on Brett Ratner. I've said this before. I think he's a decent filmmaker.
Yeah.
I'm not nuts about his movies. He's never made anything that I was just over the moon about. But I don't think he's ever made anything that I absolutely hated either. He gets a lot of shit, and I think undeservedly so. I think he's a fairly talented filmmaker. I just don't think he's made the right property yet.
Well, yeah, it's not like when I came out of Beverly Hills Cop 3 or even when I came out of Beverly Hills Cop 2, I wanted a sequel. I mean, it's not like I said, oh my God, they're going to make a Beverly Hills Cop 4. I mean, enough already. These things serve their purpose. I just don't see there being a need for a Beverly Hills Cop 4, to be honest with you.
It's true. That's true. Having said that, I sort of root for Eddie Murphy because Eddie Murphy is so talented. And it's weird. I was having this conversation with someone the other day. Nutty Professor came out in 1996, and that was a comeback movie.
Yeah.
And that was 14 years ago or whatever it was. I mean, that, and that was his comeback 14 years ago. And if you look at his body of work since then, it has actually been much, much worse than the movies that Nutty Professor was a comeback from. I would love to see A Vampire in Brooklyn come out now. I mean, that would be a step up from the stuff he's been
doing. Yeah. Metro would be a step up.
Exactly. Metro would be a step up from the stuff he's been making. But he's just... So he really is so talented, and from such an early age he was so talented. I still root for Eddie Murphy because I think he's incredibly talented.
Yeah.
So I'll go see it because I just want him to make something that's for adults as opposed to Imagine That or Shrek or you know, Norbit or whatever he's been making for the past 15 years.
Okay, I'm gonna name some movies before we close out. I expanded the show a little bit just so we could get this in. Name some movies and switch between you two and get your impressions on the possibilities of these films. We'll start with you, Jerry.
Oh, shit.
Emilia.
I think it's a perfect role for Hilary Swank, whether it's, and I like the director, but I just honestly don't know.
Do you think that they'll do you think that it'll include, like, a kind of, oh, it's time to wake up. do you think it'll include a kind of definitive ending?
No, I don't. I don't. I think it's an interesting movie, and I think it's a perfect role for her, but I don't know if it will include. I don't know that much about the film except for the trailer that we've all seen. That's all I know about the film.
Okay, Chris, I'm going to love this. We're actually going to welcome on the director of this film in a couple of weeks. Chris, 2012.
Wow.
Don't buy a real estate.
No, it's not my kind of movie. I'll preface this with that. This is just not my kind of movie. I don't have any interest in seeing it. I think it'll make some money, but I don't think it's going to be, I really just have very, very little to say about it. I was not interested in the preview. I mean, it's exactly the kind of preview that I detest. There's two kinds of previews that I detest. Movies that give away too much information, and movies that just give the same information over and over again. This movie does both, because it gives the same information over and over again in the trailer, which is just a series of explosions,
yeah.
But it also gives away too much about the movie, because I think the movie is exactly that, just a series of explosions.
Yeah.
So I don't hold out a lot of hope for this movie. I like John Cusack. I like Woody Harrelson, but that's not enough for me.
Yeah. I need to say something about the movie, though. First of all, I think it's really scary that there's a director that can make Michael Bay look restrained. But what I really find about this movie is this movie, and then in January we have The Book of Eli. And in between that, we have The Road, which has been delayed for a very long time. And I don't know what the Weinsteins and their marketing has done to decide that the Wednesday before Thanksgiving is the appropriate time to release The Road. I really just don't. The Road was supposed to come out the same day as Quantum of Solace last year.
Here's the thing. The Road doesn't stand a chance.
Oh, The Road is finished. The Road is basically... I hope that it's going to be on demand at the same time, you know?
Anyone who's read The Road understands that it's a great book, and any filmmaker that tries to make it, I'm sure it'll be a valiant effort. John Hillcoat, I think, is extremely talented, but the movie doesn't stand a chance. The book is 95% internal narrative.
Yeah.
It has almost no action in it whatsoever. You know, the trailers and some of the reviews talk up this cannibalism thing. That is about 2% of the book. It's a very small amount. I'm sure they amped it up a little bit for the movie, but it's not going to be enough to overcome the fact that book is 95% internal narrative.
Oh, yeah. No,
just,
I agree with you.
It will not translate.
It's not going to translate, but I just think you're putting it in between these two big, basically similar themed, you know, apocalyptic movies. I mean, the film it never stood a chance to begin with, but it really doesn't stand a chance now.
No, it doesn't.
People are going to be, after 2012, I don't even know how The Book of Eli is going to do, quite honestly. And that's got I love Denzel Washington, and it's a Hughes Brothers directing Denzel Washington, but you've got this big thing 2012, this monster of a film, and it's just how much are people going to really tolerate after a while?
I'm excited about Book of Eli just because we get another Gary Oldman performance.
Oh, yeah. Anytime we get a Gary Oldman performance is great.
Yeah. All right, Jerry, here you go. Here's another upcoming film next month, The Box.
I think this is where Richard Kelly basically says, I own all of you. I'm not joking when I say that. It's very important that he's doing, of all things, a Richard Matheson story. But Richard Kelly is just one of those visionary directors that we have, and he's going to say, okay, I've shown you all what my imagination consists of. I'm going to prove to you that I can do someone else's work, and I'm going to wash the floor with all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said it right there, okay? Please, Richard, come on the show. Please. I beg
you. Chris, do you – well, we'll try to get him, definitely. Chris,
yes.
Do you have a take on Fantastic Mr. Fox, Wes Anderson's new one?
Yeah, I love every Wes Anderson movie that's been made.
Yeah.
I find that they all get better with time, and I don't think this one is going to be any different. I think that he's taken the sort of stop-motion animation thing and made it, taken his own world and made it into stop animation. He's got many of the same great actors coming back to do voice work and a lot of new ones that he's never worked with. It's a story that people are familiar with. I don't think it's going to be, you know, it'll probably do about the same kind of business as something like Wild Things. Best possible scenario, it does Wild Things business. You know, worst possible scenario, it'll make, you know, that much, $30 million total. I don't think it's going to be a big hit, but I'm excited about seeing it. I just don't see any reason to doubt anything that Wes Anderson makes because he's made nothing but solid films. So I don't care what property he makes, I'm not going to doubt it.
Yeah, no, and it's really interesting that both of these guys of the same generation, Spike Jonze and Wes Anderson, have decided to make films, versions of books that we all grew up with reading that
mm-hmm.
have read to us, and I find it fascinating, and I really find it fantastic. Mr. Fox just looks so cool.
Some news that came out of this movie, though, this week, the approach that he's taking, he didn't want anything realistic. I mean, he didn't want realistic, you know, say, trees or something.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted it to be, he wanted it to be like rumpled cloth.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted paper, rumpled paper to represent clouds.
Right.
It's a very new visual direction. And the other controversy was all the people behind the movie, making the movie, say that he hasn't been around, that they never saw him. He would intercom his directions in by phone. By a computer.
Wow, okay, I didn't know that.
And they were kind of pissed off at him. And on the other hand, you heard people say, well, that's not unusual with stop-motion animation because it's such a labor-intensive, slow process. The director, what is he going to do if he's there?
Yeah.
You know, an hour later, he's going to say, okay, move it to the right. You know, it's
right.
Conducive to that.
I can see both sides of that argument. And if Wes Anderson works with the same people over and over again, so I don't know, I'm kind of perplexed by that, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, if what you have in mind is to just do a project and sort of put your feet up and take some time off and not and sort of wing it, you don't make a stop motion animation movie. You make Paul Blart. You know, you make something like that. You make a throwaway movie. You don't make a movie that takes, you know, thousands and thousands of man hours. I'm sure that those, from a voice actor's point of view, or from, you know, the person that's moving the clay piece 2 inches, I'm sure maybe they didn't see him around a lot. That doesn't mean that he's not integral in creating the movie. And you'll see that, and you can see it just in the preview. His movies have a quality to them that is that no one else makes movies like him, and people have certainly tried in the last 5 years to make a Wes Anderson type movie, and they don't work out because they're not Wes Anderson.
Right.
Now, Jerry, this is an interesting project. I think it's been shelved for some time. You read about the project, and it's at once it seems like a sure thing, and then it's very puzzling. On the other hand, something like you read a project called Me and Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm.
You see that it stars Zac Efron as a young Orson Welles, and then you're like, what?
Well,
and then you see that Richard Linklater directed it.
Well, you know, and right there's the thing, but, you know, for all the people that doubt, like, Zac Efron.
I'm sorry, Efron's not playing Orson Welles.
Oh, who is he? Who's playing Orson Welles? Let's see.
You know, I don't know who's playing. Christian McKay is playing Orson Welles. I don't know who. Maybe Zac Efron's playing an actor.
It doesn't matter. This is very interesting, because let's look at the actors who have played Orson Welles recently in the last decade. There's in The Cradle Will Rock, is it Angus McFadden who plays, or is that in RKO?
No, you're right.
Okay, and Liv Scribner played him in the TV one with Malkovich, where Malkovich was now Mankiewicz, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and okay. Vincent D'Onofrio played him in Ed Wood, briefly.
Yeah, you know, everyone who has played Welles has brought something to the part, to that mystique. I think that Richard Linklater is a very interesting choice to direct this movie because he's not someone I normally associate with Orson Welles, and there's that noise again. I find Linklater fascinating, and people hate him with a passion. People really don't like him sometimes because he makes all these different kind of movies, and I love him. I love his versatility. But I think him doing Orson Welles is fascinating. And I think if Zac Efron's in a movie, he can only move up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious.
Chris, we've talked about this movie between Jerry and myself. I want to get your take on it. They say it's the major Oscar contender this year. Up in the air, Jason Reitman.
You know, it's one of those movies that's got so much hype, and I just haven't seen enough on it that I just don't want to build it up too much. I have no doubt that it's going to be a good movie. I like Jason Reitman. I like everything he's done so far. I like the cast. I like everyone involved. I just don't want to hype it up too much because take a movie like There Will Be Blood from a couple years ago. There was so much hype for months before anybody, you know, the audiences really got to see the movie. And it was a great movie, but there was so much hype that even myself, after I saw it, I sort of felt like, wow, what was that? What was all that hype about? And it takes a little bit of time when a movie has that much hype behind it to sort of let the hype die down and realize, oh, this is a good movie or this is not a good movie. But I'm excited about it. George Clooney is really, 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 really dependable as a lead, and he doesn't take the easy choices that a matinee star like that you sort of think of them taking. He makes interesting choices. I'm not talking about, he makes interesting choices about the work that he does, but I mean in the scene, he makes the interesting choices, not the easy choices. So I always like to watch him, even when I don't like the movie, a movie like Michael Clayton, which I was not nuts about, I like watching George Clooney in it. So I'm pretty excited about it. And yeah, it's got all this buzz around it, so I got to be.
They're saying about this movie what they said about Michael Clayton in relation to George Clooney, that this is a great movie star performance. This is the role he was born to play and shine in.
Well, there's one problem with that. Guess
what,
who
else? Batman and Robin?
No, no, guess what? Guess who else is going to get a Best Actor nomination? Daniel Day-Lewis for 9.
Yeah, and we're about to get to 9. We're about to get to 9.
Yeah.
Jerry, Invictus, we're going to do this real quick. Invictus, the new Clint Eastwood movie. First of all, let me read what the movie's about. A look at the life of Nelson Mandela, played by Morgan Freeman. After the fall of apartheid in South Africa, during his first term as president, this is when he campaigned to host the 1995 Rugby World Cup event as an opportunity to unite his countrymen. So this is a broad canvas, but they're looking at one section of that canvas.
Mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood never disappoints me, especially in this decade, maybe the decade before, but especially this decade. He's really keeps showing everyone he's a student of film and makes really good movies. I don't know much about this movie, though. He just keeps doing this. He keeps making these movies, and he keeps churning them out, so I'm curious about this one, but it's the one that you're going to ask Chris about that I think is the real winner of the year.
You don't even know what I'm asking Chris
about. You're going to talk about 9, so I mean...
I'm going to get to 9.
Okay, that's a big movie.
You, 9 might go to you, man.
Okay,
you
I
have
don't
no
know.
Idea.
I don't know how you look. You're like, look, you're Dennis James and I'm a bad contestant, okay? Come on. All
right. That's exactly right. Chris, The Lovely Bones.
I think The Lovely Bones, at this point, I think Lovely Bones is the possible dark horse for Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've sort of forgotten that, and really we haven't gotten a lot of evidence that Peter Jackson is able to make that type of movie, but there was one, there is an Exhibit A, it's called Heavenly Creatures,
yeah.
Not a lot of people have seen that movie. But we think of Peter Jackson as making these huge, epic movies, and he's fantastic at that. But, again, like I said, we've all sort of forgotten that he's also able to make this other kind of movie. And I think this movie is going to be an interesting sort of combination of the two. And I think it's the dark horse for Best Picture. I really do. Because it's such a popular book and such an interesting book that, again, not a lot of people read it, but the people that have read
Lovely Bones? Lovely Bones is a huge bestseller. mean,
I know, but if you walk up to people on the street, most people, maybe where you live, Jerry, sorry.
No, all right. I don't know what goes on.
People don't read here.
Yeah.
That thing was a bestseller for like a long time, and then her second book didn't do so well, but the first book, she and her husband, he wrote a book, Glenn David Gold, I forget what his name.
It's true. It was a bestseller. But you have to remember, not only in the North, but in the South, too, in America, people really just don't read. So something has to be a bestseller. If it only sells two copies and that's the most, then it's a bestseller. People just
you
aren't
what?
Reading
this,
like they...
No, they're not
this
reading.
The same
person?
Is this the same person that wrote I Know This Much Is True?
No,
about
no.
The Siamese twins?
No, that's the guy who, wrote White Oleander, Wally Land.
Oleander, yeah. Okay, Jerry. You ready for yours?
Yeah, I'm ready for mine.
All right, big surprise. 9.
This is, like, pretty much the... I mean, it's a musical, but this is pretty much the film of films. I know you're thinking, well, whoa, wait, Rob Marshall's directing it. All right, forget that. Daniel Day-Lewis is essentially Fellini and Mastroianni in one performance. Watch the trailer. I hope if he and Clooney are up again, this is going to be nightmarish.
I'm going to go the other way. I think this one is going to be the surprise in that people are not going to be down with it. I think it's going to be the one that people are shocked by that it doesn't work.
You don't think I want to because it's a really weird thing, because these things, the musical, the films of the musicals have not worked that well lately, but this one, I mean. Daniel Day-Lewis is unlike any other actor who's ever lived. He's not, he is Daniel Day-Lewis. It's not fair to compare him to anyone else. He just becomes whoever.
I'm interested to see him in a musical.
Yeah,
definitely.
But when he's talking to Judi Dench in that trailer, and then you see Penelope Cruz, you see all the actresses, and you see who they are representing in this Italian mythology of cinema, I mean, it's unbelievable. And I know you guys are thinking, yeah, you know, Tarantino loves movies. No, Fellini did it first, and he loved everything. And that's
you know, Eight and a Half is one of my favorite movies.
Eight and a Half is the quintessential film about making movies, even more so than Truffaut's Day for Night. Eight and a Half is essentially what it means to make movies.
But Rob Marshall is not Fellini.
No, Rob Marshall's not Fellini. That is why I am nervous. That is why there's trepidation, because I've seen Chicago. I've seen Memoirs of a Geisha. I'm like, holy shit.
Doesn't it look great, though? I mean, that trailer really, really lifts me up. And actually, next to Avatar, which I'm not asking about because we've talked about it ad nauseum so far on the show, I'm most looking forward to 9, and it's unusual for me, really. You know, I'm not usually into the gay musicals. All right. Chris, I'm going to close off with this film. And this movie is a huge question mark for so many of us. Sherlock Holmes.
I knew that was going to come.
Yeah. I have a bad feeling about Sherlock Holmes. I was underwhelmed by the trailer, and it just there's something about it that just doesn't feel right to me. Something about it feels very Avengers to me. And I don't mean the upcoming Marvel project.
You mean the unfortunate Ralph Fiennes movie.
Exactly. Something about it feels very, very off to me. And I know we all love Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law, but something about this just feels very, very off. And it's Christmas time is a time when movies can very easily die. And I know it's not Christmas time that it comes. Is it Christmas Day or is it Thanksgiving?
I think it's Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
Yeah. Christmas time is a dangerous time to be releasing movies, so I don't know about this one.
Well, it's dangerous if you're not releasing a movie for the whole family. I don't get the sense that Sherlock Holmes is that movie, especially with Guy Ritchie behind it. You know?
Guy Ritchie's got the one thing, he's got Mark Strong in it, who is very good in Rock and Roll. I think it has potential. I mean, if you walk in now, it's really interesting. You're going to have a whole generation that's going to come in, an older generation that is expecting Basil Rathbone. They ain't going to get that here. That era is dead. You're not going to get Basil Rathbone. You're going to get a really different take on Sherlock Holmes here. And I don't know. It depends.
Basil Rathbone?
The original Sherlock Holmes.
Is that like a dog food or something?
No, no, dude. You don't wait. You never heard of Basil Rathbone?
No, I don't know what that is. Chris, do you know what that is?
Oh my god, dude, this is really scary. All right. No,
I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you, I just put my finger on it, and Jerry, you kind of led me to it, what feels wrong about this movie. Sherlock Holmes, the best thing it has going for it is that Sherlock Holmes is a name, and there's people out there that like Sherlock Holmes movies and stories and want to see a Sherlock Holmes movie.
Yeah.
And then there's people that don't give a shit about Sherlock Holmes. Now, this
and
movie offends both of them.
That's a majority of the population, I'm afraid.
Right. Now, and this movie offends both those groups because the people that don't give a shit about Sherlock Holmes aren't going to see it anyway. And the people that want Sherlock Holmes can see that this is not Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And I think that's going to be a problem.
Oh, yeah.
So Robert Downey Jr. isn't enough to make them care about it?
No. I don't think he is, no. I mean, okay. Robert Downey Jr. has been around for a long time. And Robert Downey Jr. has made a lot of movies that were unsuccessful. Now, it's true, if you put him in a giant robotic metallic suit and have him, blowing Jeff Bridges away on the top of a building, yeah, people are going to go see that because they like to see shit blow up. But I don't think this is going to be enough. I think this movie is going to be the spirit of this year. It's going to sort of come.
Oh, dude, I don't think it's going to be that bad. I still have yet to see the spirit, but I really honestly don't think it's going to be that. Even that bad.
You gotta look at the filmmaker. Face. Look at the filmmaker and look at his body of work.
I'm looking at his body of work and Swept Away. You know, I wouldn't have remade that. Revolver, interesting. Rock and Roll is kind of a return to form, but I think this could work. I honestly think this could work. The only other director I would really give the reins to that is so outlandish is Troy Duffy from Boondock Saints.
Which we'll be speaking to him soon, too.
Yeah, he's just quite a character. But I think Guy Ritchie might be able to pull it off. I really do.
Yeah, Jerry thinks that Guy Ritchie has an incredible body of work.
He spoke when I saw Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. He introduced the film. Very nice chap. Really nice guy. This is before he got involved with Madonna. Rock and Roller, for what it is, it tries very hard to be like Pulp Fiction. I mean, there are several instances in the film where, you think, my God, why do you feel you have to do this? But overall, he gets this like sort of new age British gangsterism very well. I'm not saying it's Sexy Beast. I'm not saying it's the old Italian Job, for that matter. But I think he might be able to do something with Sherlock Holmes.
Well, we'll see.
He might be able to do something with it, just not make it a successful movie.
No, I don't know. I mean, look, we're no better than the money changers in Hollywood. We have no idea what's going to work. They don't. None of us do. I mean, it depends.
I
on the
disagree.
Movie.
I think
hey,
we. I think
Christmas Day. I mean, there's no Marley in me. Okay, so I don't know what's going to happen.
I disagree with you. I think, and I mean this. I think that you and I and Jamie see this. And just like many fans do, many super movie fans like us see things differently than the studios do.
I don't know if we know any better, though, because there are things I thought would be a success and they aren't. Like, explain this to me. You talk about There Will Be Blood. You know, we talk about it. I loved it probably more than most people should love a movie in their right mind. But it's not considered by the majority a great film.
I'll tell you why. It only had one explosion in it. That's why. It had one explosion.
But even that, Chris, even that kind of thinking, it is what it is for the 21st century. It is Citizen Kane. It is Chinatown for the 21st century. I will not back down on that. It is that kind of brilliance. It is that kind of...
I think they were smart to produce There Be Blood. I don't think they lost money on it. And I think that if they did, what they gained in terms of publicity, exposure, prestige, even the field, you know?
Yeah, and even the field, but I'm just saying, it's not the kind of film. These films, these prestige films, if you will, a lot of people just don't know about them. They don't even know about the one that won the Oscar that year, No Country for Old Men, is not a commercially wide-known film.
Well, you make movies for different reasons.
That's beside the point. Of course, we make films for different reasons. I mean, the main reason, unfortunately, is for the pockets. But that's sadly always been the main reason. Not much more other than that.
And those weren't two disasters. I'm saying.
No, they weren't. They weren't disasters. But what's amazing is such prestigious, such intelligent, and such well-made films are not widely known.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. Good knockdown, drag out.
Yeah, I know. That's what I do.
Chris, when can you come back on, buddy?
Hey, you know, it depends on my schedule. My schedule's not regular, but anytime I have a night like this where I can be involved in the conversation, I will. And we're getting into the best time of the year for movies.
Yeah.
So I want to be on it more. We're going to be talking
about
it.
Well, call into the show when you're regular.
Okay.
Our movie song of the show, last show, was... Yeah, it closed a while ago. I apologize to our chatters for that. I just didn't like any of you and what you were saying, so I closed it. I'm kidding. Our last show's song, movie song, was Mama Told Me Not to Come, whatever, Three Dog Night. But the movie, I can't tell you the number of times my mama told me that. The movie was April Fool's Day.
Yeah, no, someone, I think, was it Kevin that got that right?
I think so. So, since we've been talking about Altman a lot on this show, the first hour of the show, we're going to close off with an Altman movie song. I'll tell a little story about this. Altman, when he wanted a pop song for this movie, he said, write me the absolutely dumbest lyrics you can possibly come up with. And the musicians behind this were terribly embarrassed by what they were doing, but little did they know it would outgross the movie. So here we end off on our movie song of the show. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Please. And you.